The Man in the Window, written by C. Dennis Moore, narrated by Greg Walston. This book is dedicated to Mrs. Lynette Barr, wherever she is, without whom it may not exist. Prologue. Caleb had lost count of the days he'd lain there. It was long enough for the cockroaches to infect his bed sores. He watched them lay eggs, and he was helpless to stop them. He couldn't move. He lay there with tears in his eyes. The sun shone outside, and through the window across the room, it looked like a beautiful day, but he was denied the enjoyment, trapped here in his own body. His nurse would be in a few hours later to feed him, but he thought nurse was a bit of a stretch. A nurse would have kept the bugs out of him. He felt no pain, and he supposed for that he should be grateful. Whatever was wrong with him, it didn't hurt. But sometimes seeing a thing is bad enough without feeling it. Having no family, Caleb figured he should count his blessings he had that woman to feed him, because stuck up here in this bed 24 hours a day, as inept as he thought she was at her duties, he was always glad for the company. And then a thought occurred to him. Count his blessings? What blessings? Was it a blessing to be a prisoner of himself and not even know why it was happening? Was it a blessing that the only person he ever saw shoveled cold soup into his mouth twice a day, but couldn't be bothered to bathe him or make sure his muscles weren't completely atrophied? Where was the blessing in this life? Whatever was happening to him, it was no blessing. Whatever was happening to him, God certainly had nothing to do with it. God the Creator, God the loving Father to all. As far as he could see, the generous God myth was one of the biggest hoaxes ever pulled on humanity. I would gladly turn my back on all he has created for just one more day of mobility. As that thought formed, then dissolved in Caleb's head, he noticed a man in his room. This man was perched atop the bedpost like a gargoyle, smiling down at him. "Would you now?" he said to Caleb. "Because I think we can work something out, you and I." "Who are you?" Caleb thought. Paralyzed within himself, thinking it was all he could do. The man made a brief motion with his eyes, looking up. Caleb's eyes followed and saw horns sprouting from the man's forehead. "Now do you know who I am?" the man whispered. "I can get you out of this bed. I can make it so you walk again, so you clean yourself and feed yourself again. No more cold soup. No more soiled sheets." He leaned in closer, his feet still clinging to the bedpost, but the man was so impossibly close to Caleb's ear now, Caleb wondered how he didn't topple forward and fall to the floor. "There's a world out there, and you're missing it. I can change that. Just say the word, and it's done." Caleb lay mute and terrified. "Sorry," the man said. "I guess you can't. I tell you what, if I make it so you can talk right now, I'll trust you to fulfill the rest of the bargain afterward. If it's a deal, blink once." If this man can make it so I talk again, Caleb thought, I'll give him whatever he wants. Even if I don't walk or move again, if I can talk, that would be enough. He blinked. The man's eyes lit up, and he leapt from the bedpost to stand beside Caleb. He touched Caleb's throat, and heat invaded the invalid's body where the man's hand rested. He took his hand away and asked, "Do you accept?" "Speak." Caleb croaked the word, and his mouth was still numb, but he could tell it was moving, his tongue thick and heavy between his teeth. "Yes," he said. "Yes," the man repeated. "Perfect." He laid his hands on Caleb's face this time, his thumbs resting over Caleb's eyes, and that heat swept through him again, this time through his entire body. He felt it in his chest and his stomach. He felt it in his legs. "Sleep," the man told him. "In the morning, you'll get up, dress yourself, and go downstairs." Before Caleb had time to think of anything else, he passed out. Night fell and the nurse came, but Caleb was sleeping, so she let him rest and would check on him again later. Before she could do so, she fell asleep on the couch. Meanwhile, Caleb was upstairs having the most horrible nightmares. He wouldn't remember the details, but there was darkness and heat and cockroaches. Good God, the bugs, he dreamed. Millions of them, more even. Every cockroach to ever populate the earth must have been in his dream. And then, before he knew it, the sun was shining again, and outside his window he heard a bird chirping. Caleb opened his eyes, rubbed them, and lifted his head off the pillow to look about the room. He suddenly realized what he was doing, and he shot up in bed. He looked at his hands and watched the fingers flex and relax. He swiveled his head about. He pulled the cover off and stared at his legs. The bugs were gone. The bed sores were healed. But even if his body were fixed, wouldn't the sores still be there? He wondered for a moment if the dream he'd just woken from had been the sickness, and maybe all that time he'd spent trapped up in this room had been the real nightmare, from which he'd now woken, only to find it all a figment of his imagination? Could it be? He climbed out of bed and pulled fresh pants and a shirt from his dresser. He stood before the mirror and watched his body at work. Dressed and ready for the day, He took the glasses off the nightstand. It seemed like he hadn't worn them in months, and headed downstairs. Excited, Caleb did a foolish thing and leapt down the first two stairs. He overstepped and his foot came down on the edge of the plank, slipped, and Caleb went tumbling head over heels to the floor. He smacked his head on the stairs as he went down, then once more on the hardwood floor. His vision went blurry, then black, and his head rang with bells and his skull felt as if it were vibrating. A vision appeared on the ceiling above him. 1,000 scurrying cockroaches swarmed from cracks that opened up and they all sat there, upside down on the ceiling, watching him. "Bugs," he said before losing consciousness. 1. When I told my parents I was moving out, you'd have thought I told them I decided to join a traveling roadshow, selling homemade jewelry out of the trunk of my car while midgets juggled flaming bowling pins on the side.
"What?"
my mother said.
"Moving out? You can't move out, Todd. You live here."
"Mom, I'm 23. Believe me, it's time to get my own place." "And you're going to pay for this new place how exactly?" my father asked. "With your art?" There was Dad, always the solid support structure for my dreams and goals. May was winding to a close in Fairfield, Missouri. It had rained the night before, and the air still carried some of that chill. I don't care much for the cold, so I was hoping it burned off soon. Memorial Day was in a week, and a few days after that, the first of the month, which, for me, meant a new sense of freedom from the confines of my parents' house and a release from the scrutiny of my father's disapproving eye. That was the plan, anyway. I'd confronted them over breakfast, probably not the best idea, and now I was wishing I'd waited until lunch. My mother sat through the entire exchange with a cooling piece of toast in one hand and a butter knife in the other, 6 inches from its target, and I kept wanting to grab her hands and put them together before the wad of butter fell off the end of the knife. My father, meanwhile, sat over a cup of coffee that he would pour in the sink in about 5 minutes when the exchange was over and he'd lost his appetite. "Yes," I replied. "I expect to pay for it with my art. Dad, I make more than you think, and I don't get so stressed out from a day at work I have to unwind with a few beers afterward every night for 10 years until my wife tells me to stop drinking or find a new place to live." "And how long's it going to last?" he asked. "Until you get bored with it?" "Get bored with it? This is my job. This is what I trained for all through high school. Some people take art in school for the credit. Some of us actually want to learn something about art. And this was one of the reasons I was moving out." "And you think people are just itching to hire a guy who, instead of going on to college, spent 4 years learning to draw, so..."
"You have no idea what I do."
"I know it's not a job." "You know," I interrupted, "you can go on all day about what bad choices I've made and what a failure I'll be in life. But in the end, it's not going to make any difference. I've already paid the deposit and the first and last month's rent. The key is on my key ring, and Brian's helping me move this weekend. I've already got the U-Haul paid for, too."
"With what?"
"I've been saving up." My father turned away, and my mother, still holding the knife and toast like a living sculpture, asked,
"Where is it?"
"In Angel Hill," I said. "On Parade Street." There, I'd done it. The easy part, I knew, would be telling them. The hard part would be telling them where. But now it was out. I didn't even have a chance to count down the explosion before my father turned back toward me.
"Angel Hill? You think you're moving to Angel Hill?"
"No," I said. "I don't think I am. I am. It's already set."
"Why there?" my mother asked. "If you were really set on this independence thing, we could have found you a nice place around here, somewhere a little closer."
"Mom," I said, trying to ease her pain, "it's a 15-minute drive, and I'm going to Angel Hill because, well, you're right, okay. My work wouldn't have paid for a place here in Fairfield. But this is a rich town. The cost of living in Angel Hill is less, and it's not that far. Besides, Owen lives there, doesn't he, Dad? It's not like I'm going off to California or something. I'm in the next town up. And while we're on the subject, this isn't an independence thing. I told you, I'm 23. It's time."
God, was it ever.
But I knew the fact that it was Angel Hill wouldn't set with them at all. It's a nice place. It's small enough you won't get lost, and big enough you won't get bored. But anyone who's ever spent enough time there can tell you, it's a different sort of place, Angel Hill is. Growing up, Owen, my father's best friend, would tell us stories. Some of them, I'll be honest, scared the piss out of me. But my father, always the realist, spat on those stories and told Owen, "Don't fill his head with that shit." I've spent my entire life wondering what the hell Owen sees in my father that keeps him coming around. "You'll never make it," my father said before getting up, pouring his coffee down the drain and walking out of the kitchen, running his hand through what was left of his gray hair. My mother finally noticed the butter about to slide off the end of her knife, and she put both it and the toast down on her plate next to her cold scrambled eggs. She got up and followed her husband out of the room. I stood beside the kitchen table, looking at breakfast and thinking, yeah, I should have waited until lunch.
A few days later, I carried one end of my drafting table while my best friend Brian held the other. Tell your friends you need some help moving, you'll find out who the real friends are pretty quick. The table wasn't heavy, just awkward. The top had been pivoted to its vertical limit to fit through the front door, and while that gave us stability in holding it up on the front, the whole thing kept wanting to tilt backward in our hands, and there was just nothing to grab back there. We managed to get it inside, then I said, "Okay, okay, set it down. I'll slide it the rest of the way." "Holy shit, that's heavy." Brian exhaled, cleared his throat, and went back out to the U-Haul. I stood up, stretched, and popped my back. I took another look around the living room. Couch there, TV here, table there. It would all look bare at first, but over time I'd flesh it out. Behind me, Brian yelled, "Shit!" just before something in the truck crashed. I stepped outside to see a box of art supplies lie scattered across the floor of the U-Haul. "Hey, man, that's my livelihood there," I said and stooped to pick up pencils, pens, knives, needles, and pins. I really should have this stuff better organized. "Yeah, well, your livelihood jumped out at me," Brian said. "You should have taped that up." "Don't blame the box, man." Brian was holding a box marked kitchen, and he carried it inside while I gathered my things. I had stuffed most of the smaller stuff into a couple of shoeboxes, then put them on top of some other boxes so they didn't get crushed. But Brian was right. I should have taped them. In fact, I thought I had. But everything looked accounted for, and nothing was broken. I grabbed the second shoebox from the top of the pile and carried them inside. In the kitchen, Brian was getting a drink from the tap. I should have thought to bring some beer. Coke, at least. Moving in summer? What was I thinking? He chugged the water, then sighed and said, "Man, I still can't believe you finally got your own place. Haven't I been telling—" "Yes," I said, nodding my head. "You've told me plenty of times." "And your parents didn't threaten to disown you? I can't believe that." "My dad said if I thought I was taking the car with me when I left, I was mistaken. He made that down payment for me."
"That was like 6 years ago."
"I know. And I had to remind him that I made every payment afterward and that the title had been transferred to my name when I turned 18, so there wasn't much he could do about it." We were back in the U-Haul, both at either end of a powder blue couch.
"Where'd you get this thing?" Brian asked.
We grabbed it by the bottom and lifted. It looked heavier than it was. While my dad was threatening legal action if I took his car, my mother slid me a few bucks to get a couple of things I might need, like a couch and some secondhand store dishes.
"Used dishes?" Brian asked. "You know, dishes aren't that expensive. Go to Walmart."
"Yeah, I found that out after I bought the used ones." We got down the ramp and Brian was about to back in through the doorway when he realized the desk still blocked his way.
"Shit!"
He set his end down and turned inside, scooted the desk across the carpet to the far end of the room. Then we brought the couch in and put it against the wall.
"There you go," Brian said. "Looks like home already."
"Yep." Another trip to the truck, and we were bringing in the coffee table when my neighbor appeared from the side of his house next door, pushing a lawnmower from somewhere in the backyard. He started it with a roar, and all conversation ceased. We were too tired to yell over the mower. When the truck was unloaded, the bed was the last thing to go into the house, Brian sat on the couch and asked,
"We have to go back for the rest?"
"There isn't any rest," I said. "Here it is. Everything I own in the world. Except my car."
"You know, it might not be such a bad idea to let the old man keep that piece of shit."
"That hurts my car's feelings." I sat at the other end of the couch and put my feet on the coffee table, another secondhand store find.
"So that's everything?" Brian asked. He looked around. "Spread out around the house like this, it doesn't look like much."
"It'll do."
"Right. At least you're finally out of your parents' house."
"Shit, I'm out of my parents' town." Brian sighed, exhausted, but he stood up anyway.
"This truck's got to be back today?"
"Yeah," I said. "Actually, would you mind taking it back for me and maybe coming to pick me up tomorrow? I got no bed back there anyway, and I don't feel like driving back there to get my car and then coming back again."
"Do what? You know what gas costs now?"
"I'll pay for your gas."
"Good enough,"
Brian said, looking around for the keys to the U-Haul. "I'll come get you tomorrow morning." "Thanks. I want to start getting this stuff put away."
"Where are the keys?"
"Probably in the truck."
"Right. I never took them out."
I stood on the front porch and watched Brian disappear over the hill at the top of the street. The smell of the grass from next door drifted over, and that, coupled with the shade of the sun being behind the hill Brian had just topped, and the crickets waking up, made all of this seem surreal. Everything around me was new, but it still carried the sense of home, because that's what it was now. No more coming home late and trying to make sure I didn't wake my parents. No more listening to their excruciating chatter about who had died or whose kid makes how much money. And now my father could harumph all he wanted about my job, because he was going to have to do it from a town south of me. Fuck him, right? I didn't have to prove anything to him by getting one of those high-paying, back-breaking factory jobs. I could make a living off my own talent, and if he couldn't appreciate that, then to hell with him.
But the most pleasing thing right then was the simple act of being 23 and not living with my parents. There's a lot to be said for not having all the responsibilities of your own place, but there's so much more to be said for having a home of your own. At least that was the theory. I took a last breath of Angel Hill summer air and went back inside. The house wasn't big, but neither was it a shack. I had an extended living room that had space at the rear for a dining table, which I didn't own, and if I was being honest, couldn't see a reason to. The living room gave onto the kitchen, which was small and would be crowded if more than two people were in there. To the left of the kitchen, just past the stairs to the basement, was the bonus room. I thought maybe it was called that if you lived alone, otherwise it was called the second bedroom. This would be my studio. The drafting table and supplies would go in here. The computer, too. Everything I needed to feel like a professional in my craft. This was the room. So far, I knew the desk would go next to the window, but hadn't decided on anything else. A large set of steep steps took up an entire wall and led to the attic, cutting the amount of space in the room pretty much in half. A small bathroom connected the bonus room to the bedroom, which in turn opened up back in the living room. If I ever got bored enough, I could do laps in my house. My house. I liked the sound of that. So what if I was only renting? Most guys I knew who got places after high school had roommates and lived in duplexes, or worse, apartments. But the gods had been shining down on me the day I opened the paper and saw this listing. The owner said it was the first day the ad had been out. He hadn't expected a call so soon. It was 10 in the morning when I called. I said with the rent he was asking, I knew if I waited another 5 minutes, I'd miss my chance. I drove to Angel Hill that afternoon and signed the rental agreement before I headed home. I'd known on the drive back exactly how my parents would react, but my reluctance to tell them kept getting overshadowed by the thought that I was finally moving out, and with that, possibly growing up. God knew it was hard to feel the full burden of adulthood when you replied, with my parents, to the question, where do you live? And getting laid? Forget about it. I looked around the living room at the jungle of boxes and furniture. The stereo was somewhere in this mess. When I found it, I hooked it up and set it on the coffee table, then searched for my CDs. I put in Bowie's Diamond Dogs, then went to work. I slid the drafting table across the carpet in the living room, to the kitchen, and then around into the office, thinking it again over and over. My house. My house. My house. I was at my desk at 4 the next afternoon when I got my first visitor. Brian had pulled up outside early that morning, honking, to take me back to Angel Hill for my car. At the house in Fairfield, my dad had grumbled a lot, but finally hugged me when I left. My mother was already making plans to come help me paint. Mom, I can't just paint the place because I feel like it. I'm renting. Besides, it doesn't need to be painted. What do the walls look like? She asked. They're white. In that case, you need to paint. A house needs color, not just to help brighten the look of a place, but colors have psychological effects too. Oh, Christ, Dad said. Not that again. She wants to paint the bedroom now because the colors we've got in there promote stress and restlessness. I told her I rest just fine in there, and my stress comes from the thought of having to paint. I hate painting. That smell fills up the house and takes a week to go away. I smiled, chuckled a little. I kissed my mother goodbye and came home to work. I hadn't heard the doorbell over the music. The stereo sat on a small shelf tucked under the attic stairs, and 9-inch Nails, The Fragile, was blasting at almost full volume. I wasn't finished unpacking, but decided I'd better get some work done if I hoped to pay for this place. No more missed deadlines. That was for sure. And regular hours, just like a real job. I kicked myself for that real job comment. The first step to ruin would be thinking like my father. This was a real job. I looked at the position of a fist I'd just drawn and decided, no, that's wrong. It needs to be more to the left. I grabbed an eraser, made the fist vanish, then brushed away the crumbles with a makeup brush I'd bought for a dollar. I only knew Dr. Cambridge was there when he knocked on the window next to my desk, earning a jolt and a shit! I jumped up, turned off the music, and went to the door to let him in. Owen came in and said something, but I couldn't hear him. What? I said, Owen repeated, and then his words were lost again. I caught on and said, ha ha, funny. I'm not deaf. You will be, you keep cranking noise like that. What, that? You should give it a listen. You'd like it. Uh-huh. Owen was wandering around the living room, inspecting the site. I'd known Owen all my life and had come to think of him as a second father. A cooler father who never told me I was going to fail just because I had done something my own way instead of the way he'd suggested. But those feelings also led me sometimes to feeling as if because I could impress Owen, I had to. And if Owen thought I had done good in finding a place to live, the report back, and I had no delusions to the contrary, this was an inspection, not a friendly visit, would be positive. I like your place, Owen said. I mean, I really like it. Man, this is so much better than my first place. Where was that? After high school, your father and I rented a duplex. It was a shithole. No, that's not true. It wasn't bad. But this is pretty nice. Thanks. I wasn't sure what I was thanking him for. It wasn't as if the condition of the house were due to my presence. I'd only been here a day. How many rooms? Owen asked, wandering into the kitchen. 4, I said, accompanying him. You want anything? I reached into the fridge and grabbed a Coke. No, thanks. When I opened the refrigerator door, Owen would have had a clear view of the 4 items on the shelves. Milk, a case of Coke, a pack of deli-sliced turkey, and a jar of grape jelly. On the counter next to the sink were a loaf of bread, a jar of extra chunky peanut butter, and a box of Frosted Flakes. And in the freezer, a half dozen TV dinners. After picking up my car, I had gone shopping. I just wanted to drop in, say hi, and see if you were getting settled. Settled? I popped the tab on the Coke. I just got here. Yeah, well, I finished. You can tell him it's not a rat-infested hole in the ground, okay? No, that's not it, Owen said. I mean, well, yeah, he mentioned something about me checking in on you, but he meant, you know, once you got unpacked and all that. But I wanted to say hi and see the place anyway. So it meets your approval? I like it, Owen said again, nodding. He found the office and stood looking at the sketch on my desk. What's this? Just work, I said. What's the book? Owen picked up the pages on my computer desk and leafed through them. My father would never have done that, but Owen had actually bothered to learn what it was I did for a living. He read the title. Of Wolf and Man? Werewolves, I said. I figured. Any good? Yeah, the limited edition's coming out soon, so they asked me to... I nodded toward the sketch on the drafting table. Owen put down the pages and peeked into the doorway across the room. Bathroom? He asked. And leads to the bedroom, I finished. Well, it is a nice place, Owen said. Yeah, he's not right quite as often as he thinks, I said, meaning my father. I think I'll be just fine here. I think so, too, Owen said. But for God's sake, don't tell him what you just said about him not being right as often as he thinks. We both chuckled, and Owen said, Well, look, I just wanted to stop in, but I got to get to the hospital. I trust your report will look favorably on me? Of course. And you're sure you can live in Angel Hill? You're not going to be scared away? You kidding me? I can do anything. I fucking rule, man. You're a dork, Owen said. I shrugged. When he left, I closed the door, then turned to go back to work, but suddenly stopped, frozen. I'd seen... No, it couldn't have been. I sprayed just before I moved in. The house should be clean, but damned if there wasn't a bug inching across the kitchen floor. A big, shiny cockroach. I slipped into my shoes by the door and darted into the kitchen. What the fuck you doing here? I said as I stomped the bug. It gave a crunch under my shoe and I went out to the front porch to wipe it off my sole. I'd have to call an exterminator and get the job done right. I left my shoes on while I worked the rest of the day. Ugh. I was going to say I fucking hate bugs, but that doesn't even come close. I shudder with revulsion just thinking about them. If I'm eating and something comes on TV with cockroaches, the food is trash because I can't finish it. Filthy, nasty little shitbags. My neighbor was mowing his lawn again when I woke up on the couch in the middle of a hot afternoon. The pages I'd been going over lie scattered across the floor. I must have been holding them when I dozed off. I got up, gathered the pages, and stacked them on the coffee table, then went into the kitchen. Christ, it was muggy. I wonder if the stories about Angel Hill had started because this place was the center of hell. I got a bottle of water and chugged it. The clock read just past 2. One more bottle of water, then I'd go back to work. Then the phone rang. When I picked up, Brian's voice said, Hey, I was looking around my place today and found something here I meant to give you. Silence followed, and I knew Brian was flipping me off over the phone. No thanks, I said. I already got one. I returned the favor by flipping off my own phone. What's going on? Working. No, I take that back. I just woke up. Then I'm going back to work. I had been working steadily the past 2 years, after 3 solid years of struggling to get work, sending samples out to whomever I thought would take them. I got the occasional job here and there, but I'd never made enough to live on until recently. Now I had 2 small presses I did steady work for, and another 3 or 4 who used me when one of their regulars didn't have time for another project. And on top of all that, I'd recently signed with a fledgling greeting card company somewhere in New England to provide the cartoons for their cards. When it came to my reputation, I admitted it myself. I ain't no G.A.K., no Eric Wilson, but famous or not, I paid my bills, as long as I kept the naps to a minimum. Sleeping? Brian said. In the middle of the day? Have you seen it outside? Man, I've been working my ass off this week, and I'm trying to get more work. Slow down there, man. Don't wear yourself out. Overtime's for squares. I know, I said. I'm not. I just want to make sure I've got enough to do to pay for this place. You reconsidering? No way, I said, shaking my head, even though Brian couldn't see me. But it's not like I'm making a weekly paycheck, and sometimes there's just no work. I want to be ready for that and make sure I've still got some money saved. I doubt the landlord's going to care one way or another if there's work or not. He's going to want his rent. Should have thought of that before you decided to do that instead of getting a real job. Did you want something? Right, Brian said. I forgot. Hey, it's hotter than shit out today. We're all going to Oceans of Fun. You want to come? I grabbed the pages from the living room and carried them back to the office. Nah, I got to get back to work. Besides, that place is fucking expensive. I'm a struggling artist.
Right,
Brian said. Well, Janice will be in a bikini, but I guess I'll have to enjoy it myself while you're home, suffering in the heat, pulling skin. Yeah, I said. We hung up, and I turned on some Bowie and sat down at my desk. Bowie'd been a staple of my work routine almost from the beginning. In fact, some of my earliest drawings were visual interpretations of his music. The grossly mutated, almost human diamond dogs looming over Hunger City, or stalking its post-apocalyptic streets. The androgynous and enigmatic Ziggy Stardust turning on as he committed his rock and roll suicide. Scenes from the panic that ravaged Detroit. Or an unwashed and somewhat slightly dazed Major Tom staring blankly out of the portal of his tin can. I found the early lyrics inspirational and had committed them to pictures, some of which had gone to friends, some had gone into my portfolio, and had helped land my first job. I was doing 5 illustrations for Christopher Fulbright's novel, Of Wolf and Man, and when I set the 4th one aside to cool, I went to work on the 5th. I'd reached for another sheet of Bristol, but found I'd just used the last one. I'd just bought some before I packed, so there should be some around here. I got up and searched the room, but that didn't take long, and there was no more Bristol to be found. I stood in the middle of the room trying to figure out what I'd done with it when I remembered there were a few unpacked boxes in the attic, mostly winter clothes and some camping equipment, stuff I didn't need yet and didn't have a place for down here. The attic was big, like another room above the living room, and if I ever needed a guest room or something, I could easily put it up here. As long as the guest didn't mind the exposed insulation and the general creepiness of the room, I went through the boxes, but still no paper. Maybe the basement? I put the empty boxes down there with the intention of slowly putting them out with the garbage one or two at a time. Maybe I'd overlooked the Bristol in one of them? It was the only other place that I could think of that it might be. I made my way slowly down the attic stairs, holding onto the wall so as not to fall. They were steep going up, but looking down at them, they were positively dangerous. The basement stairs were different. A set of 5 led from the kitchen away from the house, then came to a landing, and turned back toward the house and under it with the last 5 stairs. In the basement, I found 3 boxes marked Work. In 2 of them, I found a few old sketches and my old portfolio. In another box were extra supplies, including some more Bristol paper. I also found my old backpack from high school. I looked at the portfolio and the backpack and thought, when did I pack these? And why didn't I unpack them? What's all this stuff doing down here? I pulled the backpack out of the box and looked at it as an archaeologist might have looked at the first dinosaur bone. It was heavy. Well, not heavy, but weighted. There was something in it. I wanted to open it, but something inside, a memory or something, wouldn't let me. I grabbed one of the zippers and felt a fear, an anxiety, rush through me. Something about bugs and doors. Insanity. I shivered at the bugs, shoved the thoughts away, and opened it anyway. It was full of pencils. Colored pencils. Not sure why. I had a shitload upstairs. I let out my breath, zipped the backpack, and put it in the box with the portfolio and folded the flaps in. I grabbed the box of supplies and carried it upstairs. A few hours later, I needed another break. I decided I wanted to bring the portfolio up. There were sketches in it, very old ones, and I wanted to compare the work I'd done this afternoon with the work I'd done years ago. It's a thing we artists do from time to time. Look at the old stuff, compare it with the new, and pray to God there's an improvement. I don't know about all the others, but I'd assume it's the same for writers, musicians, anyone that does something like this. At least the ones who care about what they do and strive to be the best they can at it. I've met a few writers through my work who simply don't seem to care that they're writing the same stuff they wrote 5 years ago. And it's all the same. Shit. I had one guy once contacted me, asked if I'd like to collaborate with him on a comic book idea he had. Shit, yeah, I said. Something like that gets picked up, you've hopefully got a steady gig. Then I read his idea. There's a fine line between integrity and stupidity, but sometimes that line is rendered crystal clear and you're able to back away from something with full knowledge, a clean conscience, and no regrets. Far as I know, that idea was rejected by every comic company it was submitted to. I have no idea who he got to draw it for him. I know it wasn't me, thank God. What was I talking about? Right, my old sketches. I opened the basement door and went down the first set of stairs. I turned on the landing, and it's all still kind of blurry, it happened so fast, but I think as I was setting my foot down on the next step, I saw a huge, fat cockroach scurry across the floor at the foot of the steps. I tried to pull my foot back before it contacted with the steps. I failed, lost my balance, and instead my foot slid through the gap while the rest of me tumbled to the concrete floor. My head smacked the cement, but that was nothing when my leg snapped in half and I felt the fire throughout my entire body, like someone had opened me up and poured lava into the wound. Everything went black, then white, then the world was spinning, and I was fighting to catch my breath, clenching my teeth, with tears streaming from my eyes. My legs slipped free of the stairs, and I rolled across the floor, writhing and crying. No shit, honest to God crying, like a fucking baby. Holy fuck, did it hurt so bad I didn't care. I must have lain there on the basement floor for hours, even though later I figured it out to be no more than maybe 10 minutes, trying to get up the nerve to move, terrified that the slightest twitch would send that pain through me again. Have to get up, I thought. Can't stay down here. I got up slowly. I held the leg above the ground, bent as far as I could bear, shaking from the pain. With just the one leg, I couldn't move without hopping, and I couldn't hop without sending spikes through the other leg again. I just couldn't. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't sit down. I couldn't stand. And my vision kept going black. My head was still spinning. I'd only rolled a few feet from the stairs and found I was able to lean toward them and grab the handrail. It was just an old length of pipe attached to the wall. I figured if I could sit on the stairs, I could use the rail like a pull-up bar and get myself up to the landing. My arms were weak and trembling, and my palms sweaty, and if I'd thought I'd lay on the floor for hours, that was nothing compared to how long it seemed I was struggling up those stairs. Once, my heel tapped a stair, and I had to stop and grind my teeth together while I shook the pain out through my hands and my good leg, panting and staring at the broken one. The bone hadn't broken the skin, thank God, but it had already swollen so big I was actually afraid it might burst. I got turned around on the landing and scooted backwards up the last few steps the same way, hauling myself up one at a time with the handrail. Finally in the kitchen, I lay back against the cool linoleum floor and stared at the ceiling. I caught my breath and tried to calm the fire in my blood. Sweat covered my forehead, and my hair stuck to it in a wet tangle of brown. My throat burned from the panting. I leaned my head back, searching upside down across the room, wondering how I was going to get up to reach the phone and call an ambulance. But once I found the base and realized the handset wasn't there, I lay there trying to remember where it was. My call from Brian earlier came back, and I remembered setting it down in the office. How I got to the office, I don't know. I think I blacked out for a second. Maybe aliens appeared and carried me in there, but there I was with the phone in my hands, dialing 911. After hanging up, I wondered if they'd come in by themselves or not. To be safe, I decided to put myself in their line of sight. I didn't need to be on the porch with a beer waiting for them. In the kitchen doorway, visible from the front door, would do. A long time passed again while I struggled across the kitchen floor, every start and stop sending more acid through my system. The pain was no longer confined to my leg. It seemed my whole body was broken. Holy Jesus Christ, I panted when I finally made the doorway. I lay there, wishing I could just go into shock or something, a coma, anything to stop feeling this. I felt my mind drifting, felt the world swelling and wobbling around me. Across the floor, a cockroach the size of a squirrel vanished after slipping impossibly beneath the baseboard. My leg was purple and oozing green slime from a dozen ruptures where the inner swelling had become too much for the flesh. Across the room, a bald man with glasses stared at me through the front window before turning and strolling silently off the porch to disappear into the bushes bordering my neighbor's yard. My father sat on my couch, shaking his head in shame and telling me my room was still waiting for me back in Fairfield. I felt myself drifting and in the back of my mind thought, finally. I woke again in the ambulance, but was still drifting in and out when they rolled me in through the doors to the emergency room. If I thought the brake had hurt, I hadn't felt anything until they had to set it. I spent that night in the hospital and was sent home the next day with a pair of crutches, a month's supply of painkillers, and a promise of a bill I couldn't pay. My mother flipped out while my father just grumbled in the background about how he knew something was going to happen in Angel Hill with me on my own out there, as if I'd moved to the middle of nowhere hundreds of miles away. I spent the first 2 days after that on the couch, sleeping. This new pill they had me on, Daitril, was a wonder and a half. A pill every 8 hours and the pain was a memory. The drawback was, so was most of the world, because the pills knocked me flat on my ass. I probably spent more time sleeping in those few days than any other week-long period of my life. On the third day, as I lay in the bed I had somehow managed to crawl to, I dreamed for the first time since coming home. I dreamed of bugs, roaches, and beetles. Great big ones with slick, shiny backs and big,
prickly legs that crawled over me and made me scream. I was in high school. Mr. James, our psychology teacher, had arranged a field trip to the state hospital. In my dream, we were on the third floor. The big nurse with a bun on her head, the one who had taken us to the third floor, had just told us about the padded rooms. Then, as the horrified class watched, her eyes bulged, her chest heaved, and her head lolled back. Her body broke apart like a cocoon and out crawled a giant cockroach. Then I looked around at the students, and they too had broken apart and been replaced by roaches and beetles. I thought in my dream panic, I go to school with them. I sit in the same classroom. I eat my lunch with bugs. I turned and ran, but I looked over my shoulder once, and when I looked back, I ran into a big metal door. My head smacked it with a thud, and I stood there, trying to rub the spot. There was a slot in the door, small enough to fit a hand through, but no more. Someone was inside the room, looking out at me. But someone had red eyes and brown teeth, and he was saying, "Bugs, bugs, 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 bugs," over and over. I woke up. I sat up, dazed and silent. I gazed about the room, not sure what I expected to find. I looked over toward the mirror and was actually a little surprised to not find something out of Kafka's Metamorphosis staring back at me. I was just myself. Slowly and with great effort, I grabbed hold of the nightstand next to the bed and hauled myself up. My head was swimming. The crutches were on the other side of the room, and I had to hobble to them. I got to the crutches, then moved to the living room and settled onto the couch. It was almost 6 o'clock, and the news would be coming on. I had learned a great deal about Angel Hill in those first couple of weeks by watching Becky Dietrich and Roger Tanner on the tube. I knew a fire had recently claimed one of Angel Hill's libraries, leaving only one in town. I knew Angel Hill's mayor, Tom Gladys, had been using town funds for his own purposes every so often. I knew Becky Dietrich had an amazing rack, was fine as hell, and she didn't wear a wedding ring. I turned on the television. The picture focused, and I watched a commercial for fabric softener. After that was over, the KNGL news theme came on, and I watched. Becky Dietrich opened the broadcast with a story about the annual Angel Hill August 1st parade, when the whole city, roughly 50,000 people, came together along Vogel Street and celebrated another summer. All this time, hearing stories about Angel Hill growing up, and here I lived in the town, watched the news every day, and had yet to see anything strange going on. I started to wonder if maybe all those stories really were bullshit. Then I got lost staring at Becky again and wishing I were under that desk. The next day, I finally decided to try working. I still had one more of Wolf and Man illustration to finish, and with the hospital bill, I needed the money. There's a lot to be said for being self-employed, but ask anyone who is, and the one thing most of them will complain about is insurance. There isn't any. You work for yourself in a job like illustrating, writing, or whatever, and you get hurt. Tough shit for you. Pay the bill. I turned on my computer to check the mail for the first time in a week and found a new PDF file with a note waiting for me. This is the next book on the schedule. I'm hoping to go to press with it in a month if you can get the illos done by then. I opened the file and saw it was just under 300 pages. I'd be able to work in 5 or 6 illustrations for a book that length, and since I needed the money more now than ever, I decided to go with 6. I made sure I had enough paper, then printed the file. While that ran, I went into the living room, grabbed the pill bottle from the coffee table, and shook out one of the small, dark pills. I got to the kitchen and chased it down with water, grimacing at the bitter taste. A thought of swallowing bugs flashed in my mind, and I shook it away. I set the empty glass in the sink and went back to the desk to start reading the novel I would be illustrating. The pill would kick in within the hour at the latest, so I'd better get as much work in as I could before then. The exterminator, whose stitched shirt informed me was Carl, asked where the basement door was. I showed him, he went down, and I returned to my desk and work. I picked up my pencil, and soon it was moving quickly over the paper, an inbred mountain man taking shape on the page to accompany the scene in the story when the two blondes hiking through the woods come upon a quiet lake and decide to take a load off with a dip before the mountain man does one in with a thrown hatchet and chases the other into a snare. While she hangs upside down from a tree, begging for her life, the mountain man starts to skin her alive, laughing like a lunatic the entire time. It's really a better story than I make it sound. The author has a gift for writing this stuff and not making it seem gratuitous, which, from what I've seen in the field, isn't easy. As I work, something appeared at the top of my vision over the edge of the desk. I saw a movement and looked up. A black bug was sneaking from behind the bathroom door. It crept out. My eyes narrowed to slits. The bug crawled around the edge of the toilet, swerving in its pointless manner. My jaw clamped tight. I fought an urge to get up and stomp it. The bug seemed to have become bored with the toilet, and it turned in my direction. I knew what it was doing. It crawled toward me. I stood up and staggered back a little, almost falling over the chair. Don't want none of that. I was sure that if I didn't get away, the bug would crawl over to me, to the open end of the cast. It would squeeze past the tight opening and climb over my toes, around my ankle. It would play through the sweaty hairs on my leg, and if I tried to stick it with the wire hanger, it would just scamper round and round my leg, avoiding the wire, and I would never get it out. I'd live the next month with the bug inside my cast. I shuddered. And even if I did stick it, how was I going to get it out then? What would be worse, a live bug crawling around in there, or a dead one oozing its bug juice all over me? I moved back. The bug crawled under the desk. I stood with my back almost touching the wall, waiting for it. When it didn't come, I leaned up and peered over the top of the chair. I didn't see the bug. I decided it must have gone back into the bathroom. Maybe it's not in the bathroom. Maybe it just vanished. It's possible, you know. Maybe it just up and disappeared. But I knew that wasn't true. The bug couldn't have just turned to air and floated away. I heard the rattle of Carl the Exterminator rummaging through something downstairs. Unless Carl was scrounging through my box of dirty magazines, I didn't care. Just get rid of these fucking bugs and bring the magazines upstairs for me. I finally managed to push one leg forward. The other followed, and I crossed into the bathroom. I thought I should have used the crutches. At least then I could smash the fucker if I saw it again. I stood there for a few seconds, scanning the walls, the floor, the corners. I didn't see the bug. Every other second, my eyes were looking down, making sure it wasn't already on me. A noise to my right. I looked, but the only thing there was the sink. I peered in, thinking I would see the bug in there, crawling in circles. The sink was empty. Then the noise again, and definitely coming from the sink. I leaned over, squinted, focusing on the drain. It was dark. I thought about getting the flashlight when I saw two thin antennae poking out. Remember that scene in Creepshow? I wanted to throw up. The bug climbed out of the pipe and wandered around the inside of the sink. I reached over and turned on the faucet. The bug put up a valiant struggle, fighting the stream, but it was nevertheless washed back to where it came from. I left the water running a few extra seconds. When I turned it off, I realized I'd had my face in there while I brushed my teeth in the mornings. I considered using the kitchen sink. I started to go back to the office, but when I turned, my eyes caught another roach running along the edge of the tub. I did a double take and watched it walk down the inside of the tub and disappear into the overflow. Behind me, a beetle climbed up from the sink drain and walked up the wall, resting on the mirror. I had a sense of paranoia and swung around to see the bug sitting there, staring at me. I grabbed a plastic brush to swat it with. I hoped Carl was getting to work down there instead of amusing himself with Dick and Jane. The back of the brush was flat, and it squashed the bug just as flat. Juice oozed from it, and I dropped the brush in the sink. The bug was smeared across the glass. I grabbed a wad of toilet paper and wiped the mess off the mirror, then tossed it into the trash. Before I could get the brush from the sink, another bug, a cricket this time, emerged from the drain, heading for the rim of the sink. What the fuck was this? A colony of them living in the drain? As I watched this, another bug climbed up my cast. When I noticed, I flinched, swatted it off, and that's when I realized there were bugs running all around the bathroom floor. I stared at them, bewildered and frozen. Shit! I expected the psycho strings to start up any second. I heard Carl in the basement again and went to the top of the stairs. I leaned in and called down. Carl, come up here, will you? Carl said something I couldn't make out and climbed the stairs. I led him into the bathroom. You have to spray in here first, I said. Carl looked at me as if he hadn't understood. Then his expression cleared and he said, I don't have to spray at all. Now I was confused. Don't have to spray? I asked. Nope. I looked all around down there. Far as I can tell, this house is clean. I didn't see any signs. No nests, no nothing. I asked again, don't have to spray? Not at all. Don't worry, though. Happens all the time. People think they see something and it automatically means they've got roaches. Sometimes it's nothing. This is one of those cases. It might have been a water bug you saw or something. They're all over in the summer, but they hardly infest people's houses. They're just ugly as sin is all. No, I'd squashed one on the mirror. I grabbed the brush, which was still in the sink, and looked at it. The smear of bug juice was gone. I felt like I was losing my balance, and I quickly sat on the edge of the tub. But I was just in here. They were all over. Roaches, beetles, crickets, everywhere. Don't tell me they're not here. Carl said, I'm sorry, but there's just no sign of them. I can go ahead and spray anyway, but I'd be charging you for nothing, really. They were coming out of the drain, I said, a little louder than I meant to. I don't know what to tell you. Like I said, not a sign. You want me to spray anyway? I zoned out for a second, and when I came back, I looked at Carl and said, no, forget it. Maybe I was working too hard, with the stress of the cast and the hospital bills and my parents and life in general. Just over a week I'd been holed up at my home. My Datsun was a stick, and I couldn't use the clutch with my cast. And Brian hadn't stopped by once to see how I was. And maybe it was just cabin fever closing in on me. Well, Carl said, shrugging, suit yourself. Carl walked out of the room. I followed, but before I got to the doorway, I saw a bug climb the wall and disappear into a crack above the doorframe. Carl didn't see it. He said there were no bugs. Then it came back from its hiding place and walked along the top edge of the doorframe. I didn't want to go under there. I knew it would drop on me. I shuddered again. The bug, a roach it looked like, crawled down the other side of the frame.
Carl!
I almost bellowed. Carl turned around and came back. I opened my mouth to tell him about the bug, but it vanished into another crack. It was mocking me, and that pissed me off more than anything else. Nothing, I said. Sorry. Carl went back downstairs for his equipment. I stood in the bathroom for a minute, staring at the crack the bug had sneaked into. I wondered why there was no sign of bugs to Carl. I wondered if Carl had just overlooked them. I wondered if Carl knew what the hell he was talking about. I came out of the wilds of my thoughts, went to my desk, and grabbed my crutches. Then went into the kitchen, grabbed a Coke from the refrigerator. I popped the tab, took a deep swallow, and felt it burning my throat. A small twinge announced its presence in my leg. If I didn't take care of it now, it would be a screaming rage in 10 minutes. I found the pill bottle on the coffee table in the living room, stuck it in the waistband of my shorts, and hopped back into the kitchen on the crutches. Carl came up with his things, told me goodbye, and sorry he couldn't help, then left. Whatever, man. Maybe if he'd put down the lesbo mags long enough, he would have seen them. And he still didn't bring them upstairs for me. As I slid the capsule down my throat, my head back and my face pointing toward the ceiling, I decided maybe I was imagining the bugs. It might be possible. These pills really made me loopy when I fought through the drowsiness. I'd been dreaming a lot about bugs lately. Maybe I just had bugs on the brain. This thought made me scratch my head as if there really were bugs there. I set the pills on the counter and took another drink. What I needed was to get this cast off my leg, spend a night out with my friends, get laid, and I'd be right as rain. A bug scampered under the microwave cart in front of the window, and I turned away from it, telling myself to stop imagining things. Carl said no bugs, so no bugs. Easy. Another bug crawled under the cart, and my stomach jumped. I gave up for the night and set my pencil down. I rubbed the fire from my eyes and shook my head to clear it of the fuzziness collecting there. The clock said it was only 10 o'clock, but I felt like I'd been working on through until morning. I took a last look at the drawing on my desk, then got up and went into the living room. My hand was fucking killing me. I wouldn't even be able to jerk off properly with this gnarled claw. I sat in a silence, in the dark, and propped my cast up on the coffee table. I stared at it. All because I had to go after that portfolio, I thought. I just couldn't leave it, could I? As I sat there, I realized I still hadn't brought it up, and the realization made me want it even more. I got back up and went into the kitchen to the basement door. I set the crutches against the wall, flipped on the light switch, and looked down at the steps. They were old. I hadn't noticed that the first few times I'd gone down them. The lead pipe handrail was rusted in some spots, and a hole about the size of a quarter had rotted away at one end. I pushed my right leg forward, letting the cast drop onto the top step, then stepped down with my left foot, and continued on down that way. Before stepping onto the hard concrete floor of the basement, I searched the area for bugs. There were none. I went to the boxes I'd been searching through the last time I was down here, grabbed the one I'd put the portfolio in, and remembered my old backpack was in with it also. I also remembered that feeling that had passed through me when I found it. Bugs and doors? What did that mean? Then I remembered something. It was about high school, whatever it was. I stared at the bag, trying to find the buried memory, but the more I searched, the further away it retreated. I remembered I got the backpack at the beginning of senior year, but that was all. Maybe it had to do with one of my classes. What did I have that year? I couldn't remember. Then, in a sudden flash, it came to me. Psychology class. The field trip to the Fairfield State Hospital. That's where it began. My hatred, no, my fear of bugs. And the last time I could remember carrying this backpack. I saw it all, the field trip, the guide, the door, the slot. How could I have ever forgotten? What happened to me that day was the worst thing that had ever happened, broken leg included. A voice in my head asked, "Do you remember the bugs? Do you remember the man in the corner? Do you remember his eyes, Todd?" Yes, I remember. I dropped the backpack as if it were a snake instead of a nylon pouch. It landed in the corner of the box and the pencils inside it clicked together. I grabbed the portfolio, closed the box, and climbed the stairs. When I got to the top, I flipped off the light switch and closed the door. I took the leather folder into the living room and sat on the couch. I flipped through it for a few minutes, remembering the old drawings, some early Bowie visualizations, a couple of sketches from some of the first books I'd illustrated professionally, some sketches I'd done for books I'd read on my own as practice. Then I came to the last few pages. These made me stop and frown. I stared at these last few drawings with something like awe, but closer to anxiety. The first three were pictures of huge, dark bugs. I had apparently drawn them. My signature was scribbled in the lower right corner, Todd Morgan. But the detail was incredible. I had never, at least not since school, been close enough to a bug, any bug, to get the kind of quality I saw in these drawings. The last two disturbed me the most. They were pictures of the man, the one in the room, the one with the eyes that had scared me so bad that day. When did I draw these? I wondered. Better yet, why did I draw these? I looked at these two pictures, and the fear I had experienced only moments before in the basement came back. If I thought the drawings of the bugs were good, they were nothing compared to these final two. There was something in these I'd never captured before. A feeling. No, it was a reality. They seemed so real, I expected the man in them to start screaming at me from the page. I flipped back to the first pictures. They were good, but not as good as the pictures of the bugs and the man. These last five were spectacular. I closed the portfolio and set it aside. Looking through it filled me with sudden inspiration. I got up and hobbled back to the office. But those eyes! I couldn't get the eyes off my mind. That night, after another 2 hours of work, I went to bed and dreamed of things better left forgotten. March 18, 2000. That was the day my psychology class loaded onto a bus at 8 in the morning and rode, bouncing all the way, to Fairfield State Hospital. That was also the day things so strange happened to me, I would block them from my memory for the next 5 years. Having lived my whole 18 years in Fairfield, I had seen the place many times, but had never been there. Nor had I ever thought I would go. I'm not even sure how Mr. James managed to get the okay for us to go. Taking kids to a state hospital? It fit the material we were studying, but still. When the bus pulled into the parking lot, my first impression was, this place looks like it belongs in a Dracula movie. Winter and spring were battling it out, and the sky was still a little dark that early in the morning. The ground was wet where the snow wasn't covering it. Dead leaves littered the grounds, and the trees, bare and gothic, stood there like dead soldiers. The bars on some of the windows did little to alleviate my doubts about the place or the trip. Getting off the bus, everyone, about 50 people in all, gathered together in two lines. Not the most anxious to get inside, I took one of the spots toward the rear. Then Mr. James led us into the administration building. Only Jack Grains, football enthusiast, caught this irony. He nudged me and pointed it out. Maybe he's going to admit us and take off. I looked at him, looked at the building again, then slung my backpack higher on my shoulder, wishing I'd had time to put it in my locker before we left, sighed, and lowered my head as I walked inside. We were greeted at the front desk by a tall, round woman who wore too much makeup and had apparently grabbed a uniform that morning from her younger days, when she could still fit into it. She introduced herself as Hedda and said she would be our guide for the day. Hedda went to the front of the double lines. "This way, please." Jack nudged me again and began walking with his butt swinging from side to side in imitation of Hedda. I ignored him. Hedda first took us by the offices, pointing out which was a doctor's office and which was a nurse's station. She showed us a few examination rooms and then took us through the patient's ward. This ward was a collection of rooms that looked like hospital rooms except for the fact that they were in the state hospital, which usually meant a mental disorder. Passing one of them, I saw a girl, no older than 8, with black stringy hair and a tired, ragged blanket hanging from her left hand. Her eyes were pitiful. They reminded me of a dog's eyes. She stood in the doorway of the room, looking out, watching the group go by. When I saw her and we locked eyes for a moment, I felt a sudden sorrow for her, wondering what had happened in her short life to put her here. When I looked back a second time, she was gone. I stopped, looked around, but didn't see her. Then I shrugged my pack up again and caught up. "These rooms," Hedda explained, "are for the regular patients. There's nothing really wrong with the patients except a few family problems. A couple of suicide attempts here and there. Maybe one or two with sleep disorders, but nothing out of the ordinary." We took the stairs up. The second floor was more of the same. Hospital rooms, a few offices, but not as many as the first floor. On this floor was also a rec room, sporting 2 pool tables, 3 ping pong tables, and a couple of outdated video games against the wall. There was a sofa, a television, and in the far corner, a jukebox. "We let the patients come here a few times a week to relax, hang out, have some fun, and have some contact with other people," Jack whispered. "Just like a regular church social, ain't it, Toad?" Christ. I didn't like Jack anyway, but I fucking loathed it when he called me Toad. If he hadn't been twice my size and could snap me like a pretzel, I'd have loved to have kicked him in the nuts. No, I wouldn't. Size had nothing to do with it. I was a fucking puss in high school. Still am when I think about it. Confrontation? Never met him. "I'll be over here minding my own business if you need me." By the time Hedda got around to the third floor, I was feeling a little more comfortable being here. The first 2 floors weren't as bad on the inside as they had looked on the outside. When we came in from the stairwell onto the third floor, my apprehensions returned. This floor was dark. There were no two ways about it. And it smelled. The walls were lined, once you got past the metal gate at the end of the hall, with doors. Big, heavy, metal doors. Hedda took us through the gate, working the lock with a key she kept on an elastic band around her wrist. On the other side of the gate, she told us about the floor. "Up here," she said, "this is where the dangerous ones are. Now, I'm not going to try and play it off like it's nothing to worry about, because it is. Some of the people on the other side of these doors are some of the nastiest people you ever met. These rooms are padded because some of them are just plain violent. It's not directed toward anyone, and that makes it worse, because it's simple, uncontrollable rage. A crazy person is crazy, and if he gets the urge to hurt you, he will. You folks stay in the center of the hall and don't..." Here she stopped, and when she spoke again, her voice was raised. "Do not touch or even go near these doors. This floor is absolutely secure, but while you're here, we're still responsible for you, so stay away from them anyway." Her voice returned to its normal pitch and volume. "I'll tell you about some of the people in these rooms as we go." She turned and led. We followed. "Mr. James tells me you folks are studying abnormal behavior. Says that's why you came down here today. Well, if you want to know about abnormal behavior, this is definitely the place to be." "Who knows what schizophrenia is?" she asked. A few hands raised, and she called on someone at the front. I couldn't see who. "That's like split personalities, right?" That was Angela. She must have been gone the day we actually covered that material. "Not exactly," Hedda said. "Schizophrenics suffer from hallucinations, voices that aren't there, delusions. We have a patient up here who suffers from it. He's been here for the better part of 15 years, and he'll probably die here as well." She shook her head. Hedda moved on down the hall, talking a little about the room's occupants. I looked at the doors. They were large and green. The paint on most of them was peeling, giving them an ancient and almost sinister look. At the top of the doors was a small square cut into the metal. Located in the hole of each was another piece of metal. To one side of these panels was a wooden knob that had been screwed into it. I assumed these slots enabled orderlies or nurses to look in on the patients without actually entering the rooms. Hedda talked. The people listened. I strayed. I found myself at the very back of the two lines, too far back to see Hedda and, I assumed, too far back for Hedda to see me. I wandered over to one side of the hall. This close to the fourth door, I could hear something on the inside. I leaned in, cocked my head, concentrating, listening. It was a voice, but I couldn't hear what it was saying. I tried to shut out Hedda's voice and the sound of the students shuffling down the hall. I couldn't, so I moved in closer. Then I could almost make out the sounds. I looked at the door. Then I looked down the hall. The group had gone down to the tenth door, and they had apparently not noticed I was gone. I went closer. For a brief moment, I thought I felt something shift on my back. Maybe it was the pack shifting, I thought. But I didn't really think it was. This had come from inside the bag. I stopped, waiting to see if it would come again. It didn't. I moved in closer to the door again, listening, trying to make out the sound. I stared at the slot in the door. I stole another glance down the hall. They had moved another couple doors down and were totally oblivious to my absence. By now, everything had become very dreamlike, hazy, slow motion, surreal even. I grabbed the handle on the slot and thought I felt another shift on my back. I held the wooden knob with both hands and carefully slid it a quarter of an inch to the left. It made no noise, and that was good. I put an eye to the crack and tried to make out the contents of the room. It wasn't opened far enough. Holding the knob in both hands again, I slid it over another quarter inch. I still couldn't make out the voice. Again, I put an eye to the crack and peered in. The voice was very clear now, but it was also quieter, almost mumbling, as if to keep me from hearing what it was saying. I glanced down the hall again, afraid of being caught. They were standing by the 15th door. Hedda was talking, but I couldn't hear what she was saying. Nor did I care. I was almost entranced by the person behind this door. I looked in and squinted. I could see him. In the far corner, crouching against the wall, was a man. He sat in a fetal position with his knees drawn up against his arms, which were wrapped in a straitjacket. The man was murmuring to himself, but I still couldn't make out what he was saying. His head was turned toward the wall. There was another shift on my back. This one was more noticeable, stronger. I knew it was from inside the backpack, but what was it? I slung the pack down off my shoulders and quietly set it on the floor. I could see something moving inside it. The door was forgotten for the moment, and so was Hedda. I grabbed the zipper and opened the pack. Inside was a horde of bugs. Big ones, little ones, black ones, brown ones. Bugs that crawled, bugs that flew. I didn't know what kind or kinds they were, but more importantly, I didn't know how they had gotten there. One crawled out of the top of the bag, over my fingers, and started up my arm before I shook it off. Another bug went up my other arm. I felt them on my legs as well, and my shoulders.
For a moment, I saw myself being covered by them, and when they cleared, I knew there would be nothing left but bones. I stood up and shook violently. Bugs crept over almost every inch of my body. They played in my hair. I could feel them inside my clothes, could feel their tiny legs dancing over my flesh. I felt nauseous and almost puked, but I knew the second I opened my mouth, it would be filled with the insects. Then, as quickly as they had covered me, they were gone. The voice from inside the room began screaming. I looked up and went to the slot. I looked down the hall. They were oblivious. What, am I not here? I wondered. The voice was blaring at me now, and I looked right into the slot and directly into a face. My first thought was, those eyes. My God, those eyes. The man I had seen in the corner was now standing directly opposite me, his face pressed against the metal, and his eyes, the irises were blood red, staring out from the slot, which now stood fully open. I looked at him and felt deep, intense terror burn through me. The man was screaming at me. Bugs! 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 He yelled. I looked down. The bugs were still gone. I looked up again. The slot was closed again, opened only as far as I had opened it, a half inch at most. The man was in the corner again, his legs against his chest, his head to the wall. He was murmuring, Bugs! 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 I shook as I slid the panel closed. My stomach churned. My backpack leaned against my leg, open and clear of insects. I zipped it shut and shouldered it. Then, as smoothly as I could, I rejoined the group at the 17th door. Hedda noticed my raised and waving hand from the rear and asked, Yes? I don't feel very good, I said in a feeble voice. Could I maybe wait outside or something? Mr. James took me outside, and I spent the rest of the visit to the Fairfield State Hospital on the bus. I awoke, afraid to open my eyes for fear of seeing that I hadn't been dreaming, that I really was back at Fairfield. I covered my face with my hands and slowly peeked out of one cracked lid through two fingers. For a second, I was blinded from the sunlight outside the bedroom window. I got out of bed, brushed my teeth, pissed, and dressed. I was going to the pill bottle when I suddenly realized I didn't need one. My leg felt fine. In fact, I didn't even seem to need the support of the crutches today. Instead of a pill, I fixed myself breakfast. When I had eaten, I went directly into the office, determined to get at least two more illustrations done that day. But 5 o'clock came, and I still wasn't even almost finished with the second. So I quit for a few hours to rest and eat dinner. Owen called as I was sitting down to eat. Hi, he said. How are you feeling? I'm fine, I answered. Why? What does my dad want to know now? Owen laughed a bit and said, Nothing, nothing. Don't worry. This is strictly a professional call. Oh, okay. So, Owen said, how's the leg? Are the pills working? Does it hurt? Actually, the leg's doing pretty good. I haven't had to take any pills today. I'm getting around okay. Not sleeping too well, but other than feeling cooped up here all the time, I'm doing great. You know you can have a life outside the house with a broken leg. I know, I said, but my car's a stick. Can't operate the pedals. Oh, how come you're not sleeping? I don't know. Just a lot of nightmares lately. Tell me about them. They're nothing. I wouldn't worry about them. That's because you're not paid the big money to worry about them. Now tell me about them. Seriously, Owen, I said, digging into a TV dinner with my fork and tearing off a piece of Salisbury steak. They're just nightmares. I'm going to live. Todd, Owen said, assuming an authoritative tone. Those pills I gave you are new. I gave them to you because they work so well on pain. But if these nightmares are a side effect, and that is a possibility, I need to find out. What kind of dreams are they? What happens in them? See, what happens is pharmaceutical companies actually give hospitals money for using their new products. You could almost call it a bribe if it weren't legal. Forget Microsoft or AOL. You want to find the world's real power brokers? Check out these pharmaceutical giants. Even today, not everyone's got a computer, but everyone gets sick. The rules and regulations are very strict for releasing new medicines, but it's not unheard of for a hospital to prescribe a pill that still has a fact or two about its side effects in a secret file. You assume they would never do it on purpose, and that's mostly the case. The pharmaceutical companies just don't want to lose the millions they've put into it in research and development because maybe 1 in 100,000 people who take their new drug might just wind up dead as a result of taking their new miracle cure. Owen is full of not only Angel Hill stories, but hospital horror stories as well. He's a real riot at parties. I keep dreaming about bugs, which is fine because I'm afraid of bugs. Always have been. Well, since Fairfield, anyway. You've had these dreams before? Not a lot, but occasionally, yeah. Well, if anything starts going strange, blurry vision, headaches, those things, you let me know the second they start. You got it, Owen. After hanging up, I tore into the rest of the steak in only a few bites, then went back to work. The next day started much like the previous one with my leg feeling fine. After lunch, I was still working on the same illustration I'd been working on the night before, and I was beginning to feel the stress over it. I got up from the desk and hobbled into the kitchen. The day before, I decided I didn't like the crutches anymore, and they'd been left leaning against the wall in the bedroom, and called Brian.
"What do you want, whore?"
Brian offered his usual greeting.
"Nothing," I said. "I'm fucking bored, man."
"What you doing today?"
"Getting ready to go back to work. Had a split shift today. Not all of us have the luxury of staying home all day drawing pictures."
"Yeah, man, that fucking rules. Now you're just trying to hurt my feelings." We talked for a few more minutes before Brian had to go. Then I hung up and turned back toward the office like a child, knowing the punishment for cursing, looks at a bar of soap. I was on my way back to the desk when I felt a twinge in my leg. I stopped for a second to see if it had been a pain or just wishful thinking, a distraction to get away from work. It had been real. The pills were on the coffee table, so I turned to go into the living room. A small brown roach scurried under the refrigerator. "I'll call the exterminator tomorrow," I thought, "but not that fuckwad Carl." As I neared the table, the pill bottle standing there like the Holy Grail, I caught a glimpse of something out of the corner of my eye. I looked to the window, and the sudden shock of seeing someone standing there made me jump back, almost falling to the floor. I caught myself at the last second and got my balance again. For a moment, I thought I was seeing things. I closed my eyes and shook my head to clear it of whatever hallucination had invaded it, hoping that it didn't only work in cartoons and the Three Stooges shorts. I opened them again. Still there. Standing outside my front window was a short, balding man in a brown suit and wire-rimmed glasses. He was just standing there, looking. I looked at him for a moment in stupid disbelief. He looked familiar. Where do I know him? After a few seconds, my paralysis broke and I hobbled to the door. I opened it and leaned out. "Can I help you?" The man turned his head in my direction and continued looking at me. He remained silent. I asked again, "Can I help you?" I said the sentence slowly, giving each word its own emphasis. Still, the man was quiet. I had never been the subject of a peeping Tom before, but from the few seconds' experience I had, I knew I didn't like it. "What are you doing here?" Still nothing from the man. Finally, I said, "What, you don't know, or you don't want to tell me?" Again, nothing. I went out and stood on the porch, 6 feet from him. He looked me in the eyes. I looked back at him, and my anger doubled. As we stared each other down, the man in the brown suit suddenly closed his eyes. He opened them again a second later. My heartbeat sped up and my breath caught in my throat to see that his eyes were gone. The socket stood wide, empty, and black. I could feel my pulse pounding in my neck and in my forehead, and the skin under my balls began to crawl. I stumbled backward as a small cricket crawled from the man's empty right socket. My mouth spilled forth a series of low guttural noises. I was trying to keep in a scream. The man's eye sockets flooded with a heavy tide of bugs as they fell from his face to the ground. Tears burned my eyes and I shut them tightly. I opened them no more than 2 seconds later to find the bugs gone, the man's eyes, dark brown bordering on red, back where they belonged. Sweating and shaking violently, I stepped back into the house and shut the door. I pulled the blind in front of the window, trying not to look at the man. Then I went into the bedroom, pulled that blind too, and sat on the bed and closed my eyes, holding my face in my hands. "What the hell was that?" I asked aloud. "That wasn't real," I told myself. "It couldn't have been real. No way." Then I heard Owen tell me there might be side effects to the pills. That had to be what it was. I looked at the window. Through the blind, I could see the man's silhouette, standing just outside. Was he real? Do hallucinations have silhouettes? I don't know. But whatever that was that happened with his eyes, no way. That wasn't real. He hypnotized me or something, surely. I picked up the phone by the bed and dialed Owen's house. "Come on, come on," I said, the phone ringing in my ear. Owen wasn't answering. I hung up. Then I looked over toward the drawn shade again. Still there. "Well," I said aloud, "I'm not going to just let him stand there." I picked up the phone again and dialed. "Angel Hill Police," a male voice said. "Hi," I said. "Look, I got this guy outside my window here, and I can't get anything out of him. I don't know if he's lost, if he's nuts, or what's going on." The officer said someone would be there within the half hour. I said that was fine. I hung up and looked at the silhouette again. "I don't know what it is you want," I thought, "but you're not going to get it. Not from me. I don't play those games." I got up and went to the office. When I got to the room, the man was already outside the window, staring in. I pulled the shade without looking at him. I sat there, doing nothing until I heard the knock 45 minutes later. I dragged my dead weight leg to the door and opened it. One of the two policemen asked, "Are you Mr. Morgan?" I nodded. "And you called to report a peeping Tom?" the other asked. "Yes, I did," I said. Then I motioned to the side of the house with my thumb. "He's around there." The first officer went to the side of the porch and peered around. "Well, he's gone now. There's an alley around back.
He probably went through there, I said. Then I thought of the man's eyes and the bugs that came from them, and I wasn't so sure the man hadn't just vanished. Now you see him, now you don't. Now they lock you up for raving about bald voyeurs, right? Those eyes, I thought again.
We'll go look,
the second officer said. Yeah, great, thanks. I went back inside and sat on the couch to wait for the officers to come back. I was reaching for the remote when I saw the man looking in the front window again. This time I stared back. I heard the police coming to the front of the house and I smiled. They climbed the steps and I couldn't wait to see them grab him. Then they walked right past him and knocked on the door again. My smile vanished and my mouth flopped open as if someone had suddenly loosened all the bolts in my face. My eyes widened. I opened the door and said, "What are you doing?"
"How do you mean?"
one of them asked, dumbfounded. I looked over at the man who was still staring at me. The officers looked over too, and then one asked, "Are you all right, Mr. Morgan?" "No," I said, dazed. "Well," one continued, "we went all around the house and checked the alley, but he must be long gone by now."
"Not here?" I wanted to jump on him and scream, "Not here? You idiot, he's standing right next to you. Are you blind?"
I wanted to do that, but I didn't. I didn't because in that one second, reality hit. If I did that, they'd take me away for sure. They'd lock me up in some hole, slap a straitjacket on me, and leave me to rot. They'd probably find me years later, thin and pale, and drooling madly. I would be ranting about bugs. As if on cue, a roach crawled down the doorway. I flinched and knocked it away. I looked back toward the officers. "Yeah, well, thanks for trying anyway, and I'm sorry to get you here for nothing." "You're welcome, and it's no problem. If he does happen to come back, just give us another call." They left, and I went into the bedroom and sat on the edge of the bed.
What the holy fuck, man? You wake up in the morning, you feel pretty good, you feel like you've got it together. Like the whole world may not be perfect, but it makes sense at least, for the most part.
I'd never understand the success of people like Coldplay or John Mayer, but at least I knew there was some kind of order in the world. But what just happened out there, that didn't make any sense at all. You're thinking, it's not a perfect world, but I understand it. And then something happens and you find yourself questioning everything else that's led up to that point in your life. How does something like that happen? I don't feel like I was hallucinating, but does that mean I wasn't? Do you realize when you're doing it that you're seeing things that aren't real? Or maybe the house came with a ghost the landlord didn't tell me about? Even so, that was a weird fucking ghost. Sure, a haunted attic or bedroom, but a front porch? And I read a lot of horror stories for work. I'd yet to come across a ghost like that one. I don't know. Whatever it was that happened out there, I couldn't think of any easy explanation for it, because no matter what the answer was, in the end it came down to the same thing every time. That was some freaky shit. But if it wasn't real, then what I had to do was put it out of my mind and get back to my life. Maybe I got some bad meat or something. Either way, I did have work to do. I went through the house pulling all the shades down. I worked through the night and stayed up until almost 2:30. The man may have been out there, I don't know. I avoided looking to find out. But those eyes, I kept thinking. What happened? I have to get hold of Owen tomorrow and tell him about it. I was dreaming of Fairfield again. I was alone in the third floor hallway and my pack was strapped to my back. I opened the gate and went into the main hall. I kept expecting the gate to creak behind me and then slam shut, but it didn't. I walked into the middle of the hall, walking on my toes and trying not to step down too loudly. I crept through the darkness, listening to the bugs rustling in the walls. I saw the door. I went to it and yanked the slot open. I looked in and saw the man sitting in the corner mumbling, "Bugs, bugs, bugs." The rustling of the bugs was getting louder and closer, as if they were in the wall right under my hands. I got up on my toes and tried to get a better view. He turned his head, and his eyes shone at me.
"Those eyes!
What do you want from me?" He didn't answer. Instead, he stood up, went to the center of the room, and looked through the slot, out at me. I looked back and felt a deep chill scurry up my spine. I felt the backpack move. I let it drop off my shoulders, and it splattered open like a rotten pumpkin when it hit the floor. The seams burst, and a wave of beetles and cockroaches rushed out and climbed up the doorframe, then across the door, covering it. The only open spot was that left by the slot. I never let my eyes wander from the man. We looked at each other, and suddenly I saw a deep sorrow in his eyes. The eyes I had, only seconds ago, thought were the color of pure evil. For some reason, I almost pitied him. He seemed to become entranced with me as well, and didn't seem to notice when the arms came up from the floor around him. But I noticed. Through the screen of bugs I saw them, decayed and sinister, melt outward from the floor. His eyes stayed on me. I saw the hands open and reach for him. I wanted to scream a warning, but when I opened my mouth, the bugs rustled around faster on the door. The sound they made was nothing short of revolting, and it made me want to puke. He stood there in his room, his arms wrapped around himself. His hair, what little of it was left, was swept back from his forehead.
I noticed for the first time that he was barefoot. I suddenly saw something else I hadn't seen before in him. A plea. It was in his eyes. It looked as if his eyes were screaming to be helped, to be let out of this room, to get away from the bugs and the walls and the arms. Then the hands closed around his legs, clutching at his knees and ankles, and began to pull him down. He melted into the floor along with them. I almost went for the door handle, then saw the bugs on it and stepped back. Instead, I just stared into the slot as the man was dragged down. Before he was completely under, I saw that flash of sorrow again. Then he was gone, and there was silence. As the last of him disappeared into the floor, the bugs began to drop off the door. Some scurried under the door and disappeared into the floor as well. Some were dead when they landed. I looked down at the shredded backpack. I picked it up, folded it. Then I saw the arms again. They were coming up from the floor around me. I woke up screaming. I sat up, looked around. Frantically, I shuffled the sheet all around on the bed, looking for anything that might be there but shouldn't. Arms, bugs, either. The first thing I did when I realized there was nothing there was look over at the window. The shade had been pulled up. Had I done that? No, I made sure they were all down when I went to bed. I got up and limped to the window. Still no pain today. Why? I guess I shouldn't question it. Just be happy it doesn't hurt. It's just healing, that's all. The cast comes off in 2 weeks, after all. I got to the window and peeked out, trying to see around the corner. There was no one there. That was good. I pulled the shade down. There was a shirt hanging on the doorknob, and I grabbed it and slipped into it. After brushing my teeth, I went to the phone and dialed Owen's number again. It rang 4 times, and after the 4th ring, I heard a click.
"This is Owen's machine,"
a shallow voice said from the other end. I looked at the phone, shook my head, and waited for the beep. "Owen, this is Todd again. Please call me as soon as you get in. It's very important. It's about those pills you gave me. Or, I think it is. Anyway, call me." I hung up. I called his cell, but got his voicemail. I hung up again without leaving another message. I turned away from the phone and went into the office. When I got to the desk, I saw, through the drawn shade, the man's silhouette. Sudden anger and annoyance rose in me, and without thinking, I pulled the shade and let it fly up on its own. The man was standing outside, less than 5 inches from the glass. The sun glinted off his glasses. His hair was disheveled. His eyes were bloodshot, and he had dark rings under them. But at least he's got eyes. I shoved the window up and yelled through the screen. "What the fuck do you want? Leave me alone!" He didn't respond. I repeated the question, but got nothing. I thought for a second that I saw a strange sort of sorrow, a deep grief, in his gaze. And I realized I did know him. Flashes of my dream returned, and I threw a quick glance at the floor. But dreams don't torment you throughout the day, so what the fuck? Frustrated, I went to the front door, out onto the porch, and down around the side of the house. I hobbled to where the man stood and looked him in the face. "Why are you here?" I asked, trying to sound like I wasn't ready to jump and crack this little man's neck. He didn't say anything. "What do you want?" Still calm. Still nothing. Then he looked at the front door, and that flash of sorrow came into his eyes again. "What?" I asked. "What is it?" Then he looked at the ground. Without thinking, I looked down too. For a second, I could have sworn I saw purple arms reaching for me, but the vision was gone in less than that. When I looked back up, the man was gone. Before I could further contemplate what the hell was going on, I heard the phone ringing. I rushed in, hoping I was fast enough and hoping it was Owen, but when I picked up the receiver and said hello, I heard, "What up, dog?" in Brian's best faux hip voice. "Oh, hey, what's going on?" "Well, shit, man. Didn't mean to disappoint." "No," I said quickly, "it's not that. I've been expecting a call from my doctor. It's pretty important, but I can't get hold of him anywhere." "Oh, well, I can let you go." "No, I needed to talk to someone anyway." "What for?" "Just being all cooped up here, you know? Fucking boring, man." "Well, shit, dude. Come on up. Ain't nothing going on here. We'll figure something out." "Can't drive a stick with a broken foot, retard." "Oh," Brian sighed. "That's right. Guess that explains why I haven't seen you in a month, huh?" "You think? I did just talk to you yesterday, though. Why don't you come up here?" "I suppose I could do that. Any hotties in your neighborhood?" "None I've seen yet," I said. "But I haven't been going out much. Got work to do." "Oh, you been drawing any hotties, at least? I need something to look at up there. Besides you. Anyway, come on up. We'll go out and get drunk or something." "Cool. Shit, I can't tonight. I forgot. I'm taking Janice out, and unless you plan on blowing me to balance it out, we'll have to do it tomorrow." "Tomorrow it is, then," I said. "Good luck on that BJ." "Luck? I'm taking out Janice, man. A BJ's a given."
"Right. All right, tomorrow, then. I'll see you later. And by the way,
what up, dog?
I can't even count the ways in which you're not cool."
"Shit, man. I'm straight hip-hop, G. I'm fly as hell."
"You ain't shit, but we'll discuss it tomorrow."
"Cool."
I hung up and turned toward the living room.
I watched television for a few hours, listened to some Bowie, and ate. I ordered a pizza. When I heard the footsteps on the front porch, I stiffened for a second. "Who is it?" I asked, trying not to sound too suspicious.
"Pizza,"
I heard a vague voice come back. I sighed and opened the door. I expected to see the bald man standing there, dressed in an ugly uniform, holding a pizza box in one hand and a straitjacket in the other. But I was relieved to see a pimply teenager with his hair in a ponytail instead. I paid him and closed the door. I sat on the couch, eating my pizza and drinking a Coke. I watched the Angel Hill 6 o'clock news, stealing a rub at my crotch every now and then, as Becky Dietrich told everyone of a fatal accident at the FET Technologies plant that afternoon, then moved on to a reiteration of the upcoming August 1st parade. She paused for a commercial, and just under the television I heard clack, 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 clack. I sat still and listened. My first thought was that it was the man, whom I hadn't seen since he disappeared earlier that day, that he was trying to open one of the basement windows, or maybe one of the back windows in the kitchen. I pushed the mute button and cocked my head. The noise came again. I got up and shuffled to the basement door. I put my ear to it, and the clack, 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 clack was louder. It was coming from down there. Quickly, I grabbed and locked the basement door. Maybe I can keep him locked down there and get the police over here again, I hoped. I got to the phone, picked it up, and was about to dial when I heard another noise behind me. This one was more a scraping sound, and I turned toward the door. I started sweating as I saw three large bugs crawl out from under it. They scurried toward me, but I knew about bugs, and I flipped on the light. They scampered away mindlessly back toward the basement door. When they were out of sight again, I returned to the phone. Then I heard the scraping sound again, louder this time. I saw that the bottom of the door was lined with bugs from one end to the other. The receiver slipped from my hand and cracked against the floor. I stepped back, but my cast landed on the handset and it split open. Then I slipped backward and it flew across the floor and hit the wall. I trembled as the bugs rushed at me. At the time, I neither noticed nor cared that the phone was broken. I got up and hobbled into the living room, got on the couch, and waited. Am I losing my mind? Other than bugs, that was my big fear. Insanity. I've often wondered if insane people know they're insane and simply can't help it, or if they think they're fine and it's the rest of the world that's crazy. I stayed on the couch the rest of the night, sitting there with my feet off the floor, my attention directed toward the kitchen, waiting for the bugs that never returned. I slept that night with the light on. Don't make fun. I'd learned a lot in Mr. James' psychology class my senior year. One of the things I took from him was that I had learned to pay attention to my dreams. Dreams, Mr. James had said, can sometimes hold the keys to your problems. I'd started a dream journal in high school, keeping track of my dreams, going through it every so often, seeing if any of them had turned out to hold any significance. He'd explained dream symbols to us, but it was all over my head, and anyway, how do I know my dream about bananas wasn't just a dream about bananas? Shortly after, I grew bored with keeping the journal, and it simply stopped. But I still paid attention to my dreams, when I could remember them, just in case. Just lately, I was dreaming a lot about bugs. The journal entries were rushed, written in fragments and marked with places where I scratched out one thing because after writing it down, I remembered it differently. Arrows drawn to connect one part of the dream down here to a part up at the top, and the whole thing wasn't pretty to look at. But the gist was this. I was in the Fairfield State Hospital again. This time, when I looked in the man's door, the dead arms were just starting to come up from the floor. I had one hand hovering a few inches above the door handle and the other to my ear to shut out the sound of the bugs rustling around on the door. I shut my eyes. Then I thrust my hand down on the handle, turned it, and yanked at the door. I wanted to scream. "My God!" I tried to say when I touched them. But in dreams, you never can scream, can you? The door gave only slightly, and when I opened my eyes, the bugs were there, dark and distinct and looking at me. I uttered a disgusted gasp and jumped back. My backpack was on the floor, and I kicked it aside when I jumped. The door was open about 6 inches. I picked up the bag, turned it upside down, and shook it, making sure it was empty. Then I stuffed my right hand deep inside it and used it as a glove to protect my skin from the bugs. I grabbed hold of the edge of the door and pulled. It was an ancient and stubborn door. It wasn't ready to move, but I put the last of my energy into it, and it finally came open. The arms were wrapped around the man's legs when I got the door open. I dove into the room and knocked him down. The decayed hands came off him, and he fell back, rolling into the corner. I fell away from him, and when I got up, I saw him sprawled there on the floor. I started to get up, but I couldn't make my legs work. The man looked at me. His eyes were sunken and bloodshot, and I wondered how long it had been since he'd slept. I looked toward the middle of the room where he'd been standing seconds before. I saw the bodies attached to the arms. They were old and rotten. Chunks of purple flesh hung from their dirty bones like rags. And there were more of them coming. Their fingers dug deep into the floor. I saw the muscles in some of the arms straining as they were forced to lift the weight of their owners. I shut my eyes tight and woke up. I climbed out of bed and went directly into the office. I found an old spiral I used to doodle in,
flipped it to an empty page, and wrote down the fragments I remembered before they disappeared. When I had marked the last period at the end of the last sentence, I read it over. God, I thought, I really am going crazy. Later that day, I stood in the kitchen making a grilled cheese sandwich. I had been having a good day so far, or at least what passed for good days in the last month of my life. My leg was fine, aside from the armor around it. I had another drawing out of the way, only two more to go before that job was done. Brian would be over later, and we'd hang out. And so far, there had been no sign of any annoying, short, bald guys outside. No bugs, either. I put the sandwich on a plate, took a beer from the refrigerator, and went to the couch. I ate in silence, thinking about the past week. My mind filled with a million different explanations for the man in the window, but a knot in my gut kept telling me I was way off the mark. I thought maybe it was just some lonely old man who had decided to pick on me. Then I thought someone from the Angel Hill Sanitarium had gotten out. That thought was a little too close to what I felt was the truth, and I pushed it away. But that doesn't explain why those cops didn't see him. No, it didn't. And I was trying not to think about that part either. Then what? What is it? What's going on? And why me? I didn't know. I swallowed the last of the sandwich, set the plate on the table, and leaned back on the couch. I was amazed at how great I felt. I was awake, more awake than I'd been in a while. Maybe it was because I hadn't been subjected to the great painkiller sleep the Dietril usually brought with them. And that was because I hadn't taken the pills in almost a week. I hadn't needed to. All I had to do now was find Owen, an objective that no longer seemed as important as it did the day before. I wondered just where Owen was. Where had he been for the past few days? And why hadn't he called me back? I looked outside, dreading it for a second, then seeing the window was empty and turning my full attention to the world outside. It was bright, really bright. You gotta squint when you look outside so you don't go blind, kind of bright. I squinted. I got up, walked. It could really be called walking now because I had gotten used to moving around with the cast. To the door and opened it. I made a note to get some sunglasses as soon as the cast was off. I only had another week of it to go. I looked across the street and spent the next few minutes watching a group of kids playing football in an empty lot. I stepped outside for a minute, still squinting, and said hi to Mr. Roman. My neighbor returned the greeting and went back to his yard work. Mr. Roman always seemed to be doing something to his yard, gardening or mowing or pulling weeds. I guess that's what happens when you retire, I thought. You get bored and you do anything to occupy yourself. I had gone through the same period of terminal boredom after high school, before the jobs really started coming in. I worked at a fast food place in high school, but quit just as soon as I graduated. That was where I met Brian. He still worked there. Sporadic other jobs followed, but nothing I could have seen myself doing for more than a couple of months at a time. I wanted to take my first summer off and enjoy myself before starting college. After the first 2 weeks, I was doing the grocery shopping, mowing the lawn, washing my father's car. I would do anything I could to get out of the house, to get away from the walls. I didn't know how I'd ever been able to stand an entire 3 months with nothing to do, but I'd done it every summer my entire life. I turned and went inside. I got 2 steps toward the couch, when I suddenly felt a sense of unease creep over me. I turned and there was the man, standing outside, staring in. Something inside me snapped. I screamed at him, "What in the fucking hell do you want with me?" He didn't answer, not that I'd expected him to, and I turned away and headed into the bedroom. I closed the door and kept my back to the window. That sense of unease, of being watched, hadn't followed me into this room. Maybe he wasn't going to follow me around the house today like an annoying shadow. Maybe I could go from room to room, excluding the living room, without my every move being watched. That thought made me feel a little better, and I headed for the bathroom. I would close both doors, pull the shade, and take a bath. Just before I reached the door leading to the bathroom, I felt him again. No, I told myself, he's not there. He better not be there. He just better not fucking be there. I turned around, slowly. My eyes settled on the side of the pane. Then I saw him there, standing, staring. Unbelievable rage blossomed like a mushroom cloud, and I grabbed the first thing I could get my hands on, the bedroom telephone. I picked it up and hurled it at the window. It crashed through the glass, missing hitting him in the head, and landed on the porch. The receiver shattered. The man didn't even act as if he knew he had come 4 inches from a phone being lodged in his skull. He just went on staring, showing no emotion at all. Perfect. Now what are you going to do if Owen tries to call? You're stuck. You can't go anywhere, and now you can't talk to anyone. Yes, I was now totally stranded in my own house, shut off from everyone except the bald man outside. I would rather be completely alone on an island with nothing to eat but coconuts, and I can't stand coconuts, than have this man as my only company. Suddenly, an idea came to me. I had the perfect solution to shutting this guy out for good. It was wonderful. I went to the basement door, opened it, flipped the switch. I looked down and cringed at the thought of going down there, but I had to. It takes forever and a day with a cast, moving the bad leg down, then the good one, 1 step at a time, like a child does. When I stepped onto the cold concrete floor, I looked around. It was dark, even with the light on.
I scanned the shelves on the rear wall. There they were. The back wall of my basement was lined with shelves. On these shelves were a few possessions from previous occupants. There was a very old and rusty hammer, a powder blue shirt covered in oil, and what I'd come down for, 5 cans of spray paint, red, black, blue, and white. I hoped they weren't empty. I grabbed all of them and headed for the stairs. I saw a roach scurry across the floor, then another, and another. Soon there were 10, 15 bugs running across the basement floor.
I glanced toward the ground-level window to my right and saw, squatting down on his knees, the old man.
I turned away and finished going to the stairs. The roaches kept coming, and I crunched a few under my heavy right foot. I struggled up the stairs. It's harder going up than coming down with this big heavy thing on. And when I reached the top, I slammed the door shut with my foot, but could still hear the bugs down there skittering over the concrete floor. I went to the living room and dropped my armload on the couch.
"Doesn't this seem a bit extreme?"
"No," I told the voice of reason. "Doesn't this seem a little crazy to you?" "No, it doesn't. Now go away." In fact, to me it seemed like the most rational thing in the world. I uncapped the can of black, shook it, and started covering the window behind the couch. The whole time the man outside watched me. I kept my eyes on the paint, never looking at the clear parts of the glass for fear I'd look into his eyes. I knew if I did that, I would surely go mad myself. There were 8 windows in the house, 3 in the living room, 1 in the bedroom, 2 in the kitchen, a bathroom window, and the one next to the desk. By the time I was done covering them all, except for the front window, I left that one open, although if pressed I wouldn't have been able to say why. I had used 2 cans of black, the blues, and part of a white. I was sweating, tired, and hungry. I hadn't eaten since the grilled cheese sandwich. I put a frozen burrito in the microwave, and when it was done, I ate it standing in front of the microwave. After a second burrito, I stretched out on the bed and went to sleep, expecting Brian's knock on the door to be the next sound I heard. Let me tell you a little about my friend Brian. As I was spray painting the windows of my new house, Brian Montgomery was driving home from work. For the past 5 years, he'd been employed as a maintenance man for a Hardee's in Fairfield. He loathed his job. Brian would arrive every morning, Monday through Friday, at 5 a.m. He'd grab a broom and a dustpan and walk the parking lot, sweeping up cigarette butts, old napkins, empty paper cups, and anything else people decided to dispose of the second they walked out of the building. Then he'd fill a bucket with degreaser and hot water, grab a deck brush, and hit the parking lot where he'd scrub the oil spots in all the parking spaces. Brian absolutely detested this part of his job, and I didn't blame him. Talk about a fucking losing battle. Once all the spots were scrubbed down, he'd get out the hose and spray the lot clean. He detested this part of his job, too. There are a certain type of non-skid shoes you're required to wear when you work in restaurants. They have yet to design a waterproof non-skid shoe, and every morning, by the time Brian was done spraying off the lot, his feet were soaked. You ever worked an entire 8-hour shift with wet socks? And the degreaser didn't even work. It may take away any oil that was still slick, but the store was an old one, and those spots had been around a long time. They weren't going anywhere. He considered this part of his job an exercise in futility. The oil spots were here to stay. But his boss wanted them scrubbed, so scrubbed they would be. Once that was done, it was almost 7, and the store had been open for an hour. His outside work done, he went inside, where he filled the milk and orange juice holds in the cooler on front line. He'd fill the cups, napkins, and straws. Then he'd go out to the shed, where he'd get more of whatever was needed to keep the inside stock filled. More cups, napkins, or straws. Then it was around the side of the workstations to stock the fry station with bags of frozen French fries. He'd gather all the trash in the building, even if it wasn't full, and take it out back. He was given until 9 every morning to finish up the maintenance part, but after so long, he usually had it done by 7:30. Lately, he'd been given more jobs to do to fill that time. He'd cover breaks on backline through breakfast, which he didn't mind because it was never very busy, and he liked to hang out with the guys who worked back there. When the breaks were covered, he'd take his own break. Sometimes he'd clock out, go home, and come back an hour or two later if it wasn't a busy morning. When he returned, it was back to backline, where he'd remain until 1 in the afternoon. Every once in a while, he'd work the microwave station, making ham and cheese sandwiches all afternoon. Sometimes he'd be on fries. He absolutely detested fries, too, but more often than not, he toasted buns. The Hardee's in Fairfield was located downtown, and they always had a pretty steady lunch rush, and he could go through as many as 200 to 300 buns in a really busy afternoon. He and Stephen, who worked the grill, had been working together so long there was almost no communication between them. As soon as Brian saw what Stephen was putting on the grill, he turned around and grabbed the buns to accommodate. It was a shitty job, but it was easy, and he did enjoy knowing he was so good at it, he had a groove down. The lunch rush was usually over by 1. From there until the usual shift change at 3, business was steady, but nothing 2 or 3 people couldn't handle. 1 cashier up front, and 1 or 2 backline people. Having paid the company its 8 hours that day, he left when the rush ended, and returned home to do what he could to scrub away the memory of another day as a fast food employee.
That smell is like a handshake for those in fast food. They can sense it on one another. Even for those lucky enough to escape the life, it seems like years before that smell is ever really washed away completely. He got home and hit the shower, scrubbing with some scented soap his mother had bought, then turned the hot water to full and the cold almost off, and standing under the spray to eradicate the greasy smell. He was going to my house today, and whatever we were doing, he didn't want to smell like grease the entire time. He finally stepped out of the shower and dried off. He heard the last of a ring out in the living room, but knew the machine would get it. He pulled on some clothes, a pair of jean shorts, and a t-shirt, then opened the door to a swirl of escaping mist. See, I pay attention to those books I illustrate. I learned a thing or two about description. He slid into his shoes and grabbed his keys and his wallet. He thought about calling me to make sure I was home, then it hit him. Where was I going to go? But that did remind him to check the message on his machine. It could have been me calling to cancel. He hit the play button. Hey, Brian, this is your Uncle Ted. Could you come down? Grandma's in the hospital, and it's not looking too good. Aw, shit, Brian said. At 23, Brian had long ago stopped wondering about his grandparents' demise. They'd lived this long, both into their 80s. It just seemed a given they'd be around forever. Maybe not. Most of Brian's family lived in Kansas City, but Brian didn't know his way around too well, so he'd call his parents and most likely get a ride with them. First, he'd better call me and let me know he wasn't coming. He dialed the number, and it rang and rang, but I never answered. After the 8th ring, he hung up, then dialed again. For the second time, it rang and rang, but there was no answer. He hung up. He picked up the phone a final time and dialed my number again. He let it ring 10 times before hanging up again. Fuck it, he said. I'll get him when I get back. With that, he was out the door, headed for his parents' house. None of this I found out until later. I sat in a rocking chair by the window, looking out at the man. He had returned 2 days ago, the day Brian was supposed to come up, the day I spray-painted all the windows except this one. He'd come back, and he hadn't gone away. I sat in a pair of cut-off sweats and a t-shirt, the clothes I'd put on 2 days ago. My hair stuck out in any direction it could. My eyes burned and were probably the color of roses, sunk deep into my head. The stubble I'd had when I came home from the hospital 4 weeks earlier had turned into a full-grown beard. There were bits of food sticking in it. If Owen had seen me, he would have cried. I sat in the rocking chair, gazing out the window into the bald man's eyes. My cast stuck out straight in front of me, my head tilted to one side. The notebook I had been writing my dreams in was clutched in my hands, the wire digging into my palms. Sitting there, I could imagine what I looked like, but I couldn't make myself care. Owen never called. Brian hadn't come. I felt as if everyone in the world had forgotten me. I guess it's just us now, I told the man. Yep, the world's disappeared, and we're the only two left. Want a beer? I laughed hysterically. Outside, the man continued staring at me. I stopped laughing as suddenly as I'd started and peered around the man. I looked at my car, the 79 Datsun my father had put the down payment on 6 years earlier. I looked at it with longing. I wanted to get in, go anywhere. I wanted to get away from the loon that kept watching me, from the loon that had invaded my mind and taken over my dreams. I wanted to get away from the loon that was driving me crazy. I had to get the stick, didn't I? I'm alone, I thought. I was fooling myself thinking this guy's in the same boat as me. He's not. He's just the one who made the hole in the boat. And now I'm sinking while he stands there and watches. What do you want from me? I asked, stumbling to my feet. The notebook fell from my fingers and landed between my feet with a flap. It fell open and the pages flipped themselves back. The man made no response. I hadn't expected one. After all, I'd asked him the same question how many times already, and so far hadn't gotten so much as a burp from him. When was the last time I had contact with anyone? I wondered as I sat back down. Had I really had friends? I couldn't remember. I thought I might have, but no, that must have been a dream. It had to be. If I'd had friends, where were they now? No, I decided, I never had friends. I never had parents. I hadn't existed at all until the man in the window thought of me. Everything I knew was wrong. I'd had it all backward. I thought the reoccurring trips to the Fairfield State Hospital were the dreams, but they were the reality. It was the rest of my life that had been the dream, a small escape from the madness and horror of my real life in that man's mind. I'm still there, trying to get that door open before the arms close around him and drag him down. And every so often I stop and dream I have a real life. I illustrate small press books for a living. I have a friend and parents and a house, and every so often I'm happy. But that's only an occasional dream. Descartes said, I think, therefore I am. Was that true? It had to be. I looked up at the man who was watching me with a lion's patience. I looked back, and I could feel an expression of indignation on my face. I tried to stand, failed, and tried again. Then I yelled at him, I think, therefore I am. Not you, you little bald fuck. Me. I think. I gave up and sat back down. I leaned over to get my notebook and glanced at some of the words I had written.
In one of my dreams about the hospital, it was night, and I was carrying my backpack. I went to the third floor and stopped in front of the man's room. Then I looked around and saw that I was on a television game show. There was a big drawing pad in front of me on an easel. There was a colored pencil in my hand. The MC explained the rules. I was playing for a prize, and the prize was a soul. The MC pointed to the right of the stage, and my gaze followed the finger. At the side of the stage was the man. He was bound in his straitjacket and placed in a cage. I looked back at the MC and noticed for the first time his ears. They were long and pointed, and his teeth were sharp. There were dragon-like wings protruding from his back. The MC said that every time I drew something correctly, I would gain a piece of the man's soul. And every time I missed something, even the most insignificant detail, I would lose a part of my own. I put the pencil to the paper and awaited instructions. When the hand holding the pencil came into view, I looked at it and watched as the pencil turned into a roach. It slipped from my fingers and played around my hand before I could shake it off.
"Are you ready?"
the MC asked. The audience applauded.
"Let round one begin!"
Then I had woken up and written everything down. At the time, I thought it was the craziest thing I'd ever dreamed. But now it scared me. I closed the pad and leaned back in the rocking chair. I looked out the window wondering, "Is that it? Is that what this is all about?" For the first time, the man turned his eyes away from mine.
"Oh, no, you don't!"
I yelled. I stood up again and tossed the pad onto the couch. The sudden change in position gave me a head rush, and I had to steady myself by grabbing the arm of the couch and standing still for a few seconds. After my vision cleared and the room stopped spinning, I looked out the window and yelled again,
"No, no, no! You don't get away that easily! Is that what this is all about? Why are you here? If this stuff is true..."
I gestured toward the pad.
"If I'm supposed to be saving your ass from something, you'd better tell me. Enough with the bullshit already."
As if to show I was serious, I picked up an ashtray and hurled it through the window. What the fuck? I didn't smoke. It crashed through the glass, missed the man, and joined the remnants of the phone I had tossed out a few days before. I went out to the porch. Mr. Roman looked up from his hedge pruning. I screamed at the old man. I railed on him. I gave him the what for and let him have a piece of my mind. And in the end, it didn't make a fuck of difference. He never said a word, and he never looked away from me. I must have scared Mr. Roman, because halfway into my rant, I noticed him put down the clippers and go inside. I turned and went back inside, too, closing the screen door, locking it, and shutting the front door, locking it, too. I considered sitting down again, but one glance out the window cured me of that. The man was still out there, just as he had been for over a week now. Instead, a new idea came to me. I had an attic. I could hide out there for a few hours, just to give me some time to relax and not have to worry about a pair of eyes crawling over me. I thought of grabbing the pad, but left it where it lay and went to the attic stairs. I looked up and thought, hell, I might as well be climbing a small mountain. There's no rail. If I fall, that's it. I looked over at the painted window. The opaqueness of the glass made my stomach turn. I questioned my own sanity again, looked up the stairs, and began to climb. I lifted my good leg up to the bottom stair, pulling the cast behind me like a comatose hitchhiker. When I got to the top, my good leg was tired and sore. Then I went into the attic. It was a large room, with insulation showing between the studs and no sheetrock covering them. There was a big window on the south wall, above the front door. It was dusty up here. The floor was littered with empty boxes from the move. I could sit up here in this cardboard jungle until Judgment Day if I had to, and the man would never see me through all these boxes. That, and the fact I was now on the second floor and the man outside was nowhere tall enough to look into a second-story window. "Better be sure, Todd." It was Jack Grain's voice. Good old Jackie. I wondered whatever happened to him after high school, then decided I didn't care. Back to the train of thought at hand. He can't see me up here. Unless he's got a phantom ladder. Shut up, Jack. I chuckled at the phantom ladder thought, but it was a nervous chuckle. I sat on a pile of boxes and tried to relax. Make that, I lay sprawled on a pile of boxes. I had intended on sitting, but the boxes collapsed when my weight settled on them. Now I was lying on them, my legs out straight, and my arms folded on my chest. My eyes were lead weights, and my mind was far away. My mind was in Fairfield. I was a senior again, and I was staring into a pair of red, monstrously crazed eyes. The only thought that kept running through my tired mind was, my God, those eyes! I'd been playing and replaying that whole lunatic day in my mind. I kept seeing the group ahead of me. I saw the door, the slot. I heard the murmuring. I felt the bugs. This last thought suddenly brought me out of my daze and made me sit up with a jerk. Carl had said no bugs, but Carl was a fuckwad. They might not have been in the basement. Maybe they were nesting up here. I didn't see any, though, and I began to lean back on the boxes again. It felt good to relax and let myself go off somewhere else without worrying about being watched. My head touched cardboard, my lids began to slide toward one another, and my eyes caught a quick flash of light on the ceiling. I wanted to ignore it, but my brain found it interesting and decided to play with it for a minute.
Wonder what that was. I don't know. Maybe it was a car driving by. That's the most obvious answer. Yeah, maybe it was the sun reflecting off the windshield of a passing car. Yeah, that sounds good.
I began to doze again when another voice, this one sounding suspiciously like Jack Grains' voice again, decided to add its 2 cents. Yeah, Todd, maybe it was the sun reflecting off glass. Maybe it wasn't the windshield, though. It just might have been the sun reflecting off a pair of glasses. You know, come to think of it, that guy who's been bothering you, he wears glasses, doesn't he?
Sure he does. Maybe he's outside the window right now, looking at you.
Shut up, Jack, I told the voice. I'm on the second floor. I don't have a trellis for him to climb, and I don't think he had a ladder in his pocket. Now go away.
Ah, come on. You don't really think that little guy needs a ladder, do you? Wake up, Todd. He's not even real. Not in the way you're thinking, anyway. He don't need no ladder. Don't believe me? Go on. Look out there.
Annoyed and drained, I raised my head, then had to fight with my eyelids to get them to open. When I won the battle, I thought I would have been better off losing.
You've got to be shitting me, I said.
He was out there. He seemed to be standing in the middle of the air. I stood up and said, quietly, as if the man were right next to me instead of across the room and outside the window,
What do you want? Leave me alone, please. Just go away.
He stared at me. I felt my sanity slowly dwindling away.
Those eyes.
The man's dark brown eyes, which had gotten progressively darker as the days went by, were no longer brown. They had taken on a more sinister shade, deep red. Every piece of my memory of the trip to Fairfield returned with a vengeance. The memories came rushing, threatening to drown me. I struggled to keep a shred of myself.
Those eyes, my God, those eyes!
In a last-ditch effort to rid myself of this infernal little bastard, I realized my only hope. If the man outside was a product of my mind, to get rid of the man, I would have to get rid of the mind. I would throw myself out this window and be rid of the man when I was flattened on the driveway gravel. I yelled at him as I rushed the glass.
You bastard! Why can't you leave me alone? I didn't do anything to you. Go away! Stop bothering me! You're driving me crazy!
As I embarked on my suicide dash, my mind ran through everything I was leaving. My parents, my job, Brian, Owen. Owen would probably blame himself, but it wasn't his fault, although if I could have gotten hold of him, I might not have felt so isolated. Owen, don't blame yourself. I don't blame you. Owen. Owen. Owen was outside. Owen was outside the window. He was standing in the driveway. He was here. Owen was here. Jesus Christ, Owen was here. Finally! I tried to stop, but inertia's a bitch. I crashed into the glass, hit my head, and cut the right side of my face on a shard as I broke through it. The glass fell, tinkling around the hood of my car. I fell. It seemed I fell for a long time, long enough to think, No, I can't die now. Owen's here. He's really here. He's finally here. Then I felt a flat, red pain on my back as I struck the top of my car. I lay there, feeling the blood from the cut run down my cheek and pool in my ear. It was warm on my face. Distantly, I heard the rise and fall of a siren. Then there was the black hood someone pulled over my eyes. Then there was silence. Then there was sleep. My eyes fluttered once, twice, then opened a crack. I wanted to sit up, but felt a hand hold me down. It was a strong, compassionate hand. I knew that from the way it held me without forcing me. Then I noticed the pain in my cheek, and below that a dull throb in my back. Finally, I gained control of my eyes and was able to force them open. It took a second for the focus to work, adjusting to the light change and the layout of the room. Then I recognized the surroundings as those of a hospital room. I looked over to see a figure sitting on the side of my bed. After a second, I recognized it as Owen. When we saw each other's faces, I thought, Jesus, what's happened to him? My God, Owen said. Todd, what's happened?
Owen, what are you doing here?
I said. I had to speak in a low, croaking whisper. All the screaming earlier had taken its toll on my voice.
I've been trying to get you for days.
Yeah, Owen said. I've been trying to get you, too. He started to chuckle. Couldn't remember the damn number. I was supposed to be looking out for you. I guess I'm not doing such a hot job, huh? I was going to come to your house, but then the Eastern woman died. Since then, I've been killing myself trying to figure this thing out. I held up a silencing hand.
What are you talking about?
I whispered. Owen looked at me for a second, unsure what to say. The pills. He finally told me. Haven't you noticed what they do to you? No, I said. For the first time in almost a week, I felt there was actually part of the world around me. I felt like I was waking up from a long daze, and a century had passed. I looked at Owen as if I were concentrating on some impossible puzzle on which I was about to give up. I was actually paying attention.
What are you talking about?
I repeated. The pills, Owen said. The Daitrel. Haven't you noticed any side effects?
No,
I said.
I haven't noticed anything wrong with them. They worked great.
They made me tired sometimes, but that's all. Why? What's going on?
I was truly conscious of the world then. In that moment, the man in the window was one of the furthest things from my mind. Owen looked at me and said, 6 people have died in the last 48 hours. I grimaced.
That's too bad.
Yeah. What's worse is that those 6 people were, for one reason or another, all taking Daitril. I didn't fully understand. But they didn't die right away, with no warning, Owen continued. The Daitril caused major swelling in the brain, and this swelling caused hallucinations. Finally, it caused hemorrhaging, and they died. You wouldn't believe what it's been like around here, like an insane asylum, only worse. If we could have caught it sooner, but we didn't, and people died. I'm ashamed to admit it, but it was almost a full day before I remembered you were taking them too. And by then, I was doing everything in my power to get in touch with you. I tried to leave here twice to come see you, and every time something else came up. I haven't slept in maybe 36 hours.
Because of the Daitril,
I said. Yes, Owen said.
Well, what are you doing about it? I mean, is there anything, any way to stop it?
Yeah, you stop taking the pills.
Hallucinations,
I said. Owen saw something in my face. What?
Nothing, I said. I was just thinking about high school for some reason.
I shook the thoughts away. I tried to lean up again, but the pain in my back roared at me to stay put. I grimaced and Owen said, easy. I lay back on the pillow and looked up at the ceiling.
My back, I said. It hurts.
I'm not surprised. Todd, what were you doing?
I don't remember.
Don't shit me, Todd. Owen's voice took on an angry fatherly tone.
Jesus, you jumped out of the attic window. From the way it looked on a street, you practically threw yourself out that window. Why?
I avoided Owen's eyes by looking at something interesting in the cracks of the ceiling tiles. Finally, I said with my cracked voice,
I had to get rid of him.
Who? Owen inquired. Get rid of who, Todd? I looked at him as if to say, don't you know? When I did speak, I said,
the man in the window.
There was a short, deafening silence. We looked each other in the eyes. Owen's eyes said, I don't understand. Mine were pleading, help me, Owen. Finally, Owen said, tell me about him. I considered for a second, then decided to go ahead and spill it. I tried to get comfortable, settling myself in for a long story I really didn't want to remember. The best I could do was a shifting in the position of my arms, trying to support myself on my elbows. I took a few deep breaths, looked around, rubbed my eyes, ran my fingers through the scruff of my beard, then said,
a few weeks after I came home from the hospital, I was taking the Daitril on a regular basis, one every time I woke up, and since I was sleeping a lot more than usual, that turned out to be about once every 8 hours. I'd wake up for a while, do a few things, piddle around the house, then go right to dreamland. When I woke up, there'd be the pain tearing through my leg. I'd take a couple Daitril, the pain would go away, I'd piddle around the house a little more. Then I got a new assignment from work, finally something to do with my time. That got me up and about pretty quickly. I guess all I needed was a little motivation to get off my ass. Anyway, I was working one day, and here comes the pain again. I get up, go into the living room, the pills were on the coffee table, and there, standing right outside my front window, I see this little guy, an old guy, staring in the window. Naturally, I go outside and ask him, you know, dude, what's going on? And he just stands there like I'm speaking Russian or something. And I'm standing there, wondering what the hell he's doing. And, I don't know if this part really happened or not, I hope to God it didn't, but he shut his eyes, and when he opened them again, they were gone. I mean, his eyes were gone. There were just these big, black eye sockets. I spent over an hour retelling the past week I had lived through. I even told Owen about the trip we had taken to Fairfield and about the horrible thing I remembered happening to me there. Owen watched me the entire time with deep fascination and concentration on his face. At the end, I told him I had jumped from the window because I just wanted to be rid of the man. And, if the man was a figment of my imagination, the only way to get rid of him would be to get rid of myself. Owen said it reminded him of August 1999, the summer night, in Ray Bradbury's The Martian Chronicles, the one where one of the Martians think the human is a Martian who has gone insane and is projecting his delusions through telepathy. Mr. Triple X kills the human, Jonathan Williams, but when the ship and 3 of Mr. Williams' companions remain, Mr. Triple X shoots them too. Finally, he thinks he's been infected by Jonathan Williams' insanity and kills himself to be rid of the hallucinations. Owen said, everything's going to be okay now. I thought I should be relieved to hear Owen say that, but after what I'd just lived through, I wasn't sure I could believe it just yet. All the same, though, I tried on a smile that didn't fit quite right and told Owen thank you. God, my father is going to flip out, I said. Todd, you gotta stop worrying about your father. You're a big boy. Your life isn't his. I know that, and you know that, but he's still going to flip out. You do know they're going to have to help me pay these bills. The Freelance Illustrators Guild doesn't have the best insurance. The freelance... I was joking. There's no such thing. Fuck.
I don't know, Owen. Is he right? I've been a month on my own, and look at me here.
No, Owen said. You push that right out of your head. You've got talent like I've never seen, and you need to use it. What, you think this is a setback? This is nothing. You're doing what you always wanted. I know it, and your father knows it. He's not disappointed in you, believe me. If anything, that man envies you. Well, that was too weird to hear. I looked at myself lying mangled in the hospital.
And how do you figure that?
Because you seem to actually be making a good living at the thing you want to do most in the world. If your father had lived his dream, you think he would have spent all that time working that shitty factory job? No. He'd have been touring the world with his band. My father's not a rock star. Christ, just the thought. Dad in leather pants, stinking of Aquanet. I could almost bust out laughing. In fact, I wanted to.
No, but when he was young, before you were born, man, that's all he wanted in the world. He had his guitar and a dozen or so songs he'd written, and he'd play little clubs here and there. He tried to get a band together once or twice, but that never worked, so it was just going to be him. You know, like Cat Stevens or James Taylor.
They had bands backing them up, though.
Yeah, but it wasn't all about the band. It was about those guys and their songs, and that was your father's dream.
He does have a lot of James Taylor records.
Yeah, and he never listens to them, does he?
I shook my head.
Of course not. It reminds him what a failure he was.
Thing is, Owen went on, he wasn't a failure. He was damn good. I mean, he knocked my socks off plenty of times just with the stuff he wrote himself. But no matter how hard he tried, struggled, and fought like a beast to get things moving, it just never happened. I tried to tell him it wasn't his fault. It wasn't his time. It was going to happen sooner or later, but it just didn't do any good. Eventually he quit, got a haircut and a real job, and married your mother.
My mother knew all this, too?
That's how they met. She saw him play once.
My mother at a concert.
This day was getting weirdo by the minute.
I think, Owen said, she probably hated him giving it all up as much as he did. When he quit, and done was done. But before that, he used to write songs for her all the time. I think she liked that, and missed it when he stopped.
I stared at him. He could have just told me Darth Vader was my real father, and it wouldn't have shocked me any more than what he'd just said.
My father, the singer-songwriter. That's some wild shit.
There's an old guitar in the garage, and I've heard him singing to the radio before, but never paid it much mind because he was my dad. But now that I thought about it, I never paid it much mind because it was good. If he'd sucked, I would have noticed and cringed, but it never bothered me, because he could do it, and do it well.
The point here, Todd, is that none of this, he motioned toward the room, the bed, my wounds, has anything to do with what you're doing with your life. This was not your fault. Nor was it brought on by your house, your job, or anything else. It's bad fucking luck, that's what it is. You do not let this ruin you, you understand me?
I know where you live, boy, and I will hurt you. I laughed, and Owen tried to keep his faux tough face, but we both knew he was just lightening the mood.
So if he's so envious, why does he act the way he does about it?
I don't know. If I had to guess, it's because you're his son, and, just in case it doesn't work out, he doesn't want to see you disappointed. You think about it. He's never said don't do it. He just wants you to have something to fall back on. He didn't. And that's how he wound up doing manual labor for 30 years. We had accounting classes, law degrees, and all that back then, too. He just didn't figure he'd need them. Then when he did need them, it was too late. Your mother was pregnant, and they needed money. The pay was good, and they had insurance. He does envy you, and he does believe in you, despite how he may act. But you know, just in case. He's just trying to take care of you. It's what fathers do.
Yeah, I guess.
You get some rest, Owen said, and don't think about it anymore. I'll be back later.
Owen looked like he needed the rest more than I did.
When the door clicked shut, I looked out the window, saw it was empty, and turned my eyes to the door. I looked around the room, getting acquainted with my new surroundings. I began to think. I thought it was the pills, but since I couldn't find Owen,
I should have known to check the hospital, stupid.
There was no way for me to find out for sure. So, Owen had it all figured out. All he had to do was get the Daitrile out of my system, then prescribe something else. Actually, that wouldn't even be necessary. The cast would be coming off in no more than a week. I didn't need painkillers anymore. My leg was doing fine. All I had to do now was lie back and enjoy myself until Owen let me go home. Sans cast.
So what's that nagging at you, Todd? Something wrong? Something not really kosher with the plan? Forgetting something, aren't you?
Don't worry. You'll probably remember it when it's too late.
Shut up, Jack.
I tried to roll over, couldn't, and slept on my back instead. It was a semi-peaceful sleep. This time, the door to the padded room was already open, and I didn't have to mess with sticking my hand in the swarm of bugs to pull it open. I spent the next week under Owen's care in the hospital. I talked to my parents on the phone, telling them everything was fine. Yes, the leg healed up real good. So how's everything going back home? Oh, works fine. Doing real good. Got lots to do when I get home.
I didn't tell them about the man and the hallucinations. That's what Owen kept trying to convince me they were, and I believed him for the most part. But sometimes my eyes wandered about the room, skimming over the window in case he was out there, looking in. And jumping out the window. I sprained my back and was told I would be seeing a chiropractor for a while. With the Dietril out of my system, the man gone, the cast no longer irritating me, and all other normally distracting objects gone, I finished work on that book I was sent just before the man showed up. Owen had gone to my house and brought everything I'd need, and I was done in just 2 days. I'd have to scan and Photoshop them together when I got home, then email them off. My scanner's not big enough to accommodate the paper, so I have to scan them in a section at a time, then put them back together. I need a bigger scanner. During my stay, Brian visited, apologizing over and over for not showing up that day. But when he told me that his grandmother had died, I told him don't even think of feeling bad. Things around the hospital also returned to what passed for normal. The patients stopped dropping like flies, and every prescription for Dietril was recalled and replaced with something else. Eventually, the very use of Dietril would come to a halt. Bad for the pharmaceutical company, good for people who liked living. Everything seemed to be going great, and life slipped back into a regular pattern. I worked the use back into my leg, but was told I would have a very slight limp for a long time, if not the rest of my life. And my back returned to normal. The cut on my face healed and left only the tiniest scar. The bruises vanished, the stiffness in my body loosened up. I began to forget about the man, the window, the fall, all of it. No, that's not true. I didn't forget. Never would. But the worry left me, the fear, the anxiety every time I looked out the window. Maybe I'd eventually come to buy the whole swollen brain explanation. It made perfect sense, and if Owen said that was the cause, then you could rest assured that was the cause. But Owen wasn't there. He didn't have to sit there day after day while that man just stood there staring at him. And what could I do? I knew he wasn't really there, so what, I'm going to black his eyes so they swell shut and he can't see me? In retrospect, I was glad he'd been outside the window instead of inside, right next to my chair or something. Holy shit, that would have been a million times worse. Owen came to see me every day, bringing little things. Sometimes he would bring something from the gift shop, sometimes it was just a package of Jell-O from the lounge. Sometimes he brought paper. He would buy it by the pack, and I would take a pencil from the drawer next to my bed and occupy myself for hours. Owen never saw the drawings. He only brought the paper to give me something to do to take my mind off life in the hospital. Nor did I offer to show them. I simply finished a sketch, slipped it upright into the space between the bed and the dresser, then started on another one. I never really paid much attention to them myself. I drew something, forgot about it, and went on to the next one. It made the week fly by quicker. When the time was up and I was gathering my things for the trip home, I grabbed the sketches. I had accumulated 37 of them. Beside the bed, rolled them up, slipped a rubber band over them, then tucked them under my arm. Owen rolled me down the hall to the elevator, down to the first floor, and I went outside for the first time in a week. It felt good to have the power of mobility back. I was tired of my movements from place to place being from my bed to X-ray or from my bed to the toilet. Once outside, I got out of the wheelchair and took a step. Finally, I was getting about on my own two legs. For that matter, I was getting about on my two good legs. Owen took me to his car, the unseen sketches still tucked under my arm, and took me home. Home. I'd never known the word could have such opposite meanings for me at the same time. On the one hand, this was home. My house. My castle. I was lord and ruler here. I was all grown up, a big boy now. On the other hand, this was the place I'd tried, only 7 days earlier, to kill myself. This was the place I'd been prisoner to my own delusions. I got out of Owen's car, closed the door, and made my way up the driveway, the gravel crunching under my shoes. Before I got to the porch, I stopped and just stared at the place. The windows were still painted over, but the two busted windows had been replaced. I looked around for the phone, but didn't see it. Reluctantly, I turned my gaze upward to the attic window. It had also been replaced. I looked at my car, the top still dented from when I landed on it. The only thing I could think was, I had a beard then. I shaved it off in the hospital. I turned back and looked at Owen, who was just stepping out of the car. The place doesn't look too bad, does it? I had the windows replaced. I slapped the rolled sketches into the palm of my hand, like a cop slapping his nightstick, and walked to the porch and climbed the steps. As I took the key out of my pocket, I thought, at least the hallucinations are over. At least I'm off the Dietril, and those damn hallucinations are over. Nag, 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 Jack said. Are you sure, Toad? Are you absolutely, positively, 100% no doubt about it, sure? Shut up, Jack. Just shut your hole and leave me alone. I put the key in the lock, turned it, heard the tumblers click into place, and pushed the door open. The house stank. No tactful way of saying it. It really reeked. It smelled of a week of dust and neglect and abandonment and garbage.
The broken windows ventilating the inside had helped a little, but not that much. I still had to let the smell grow on me. Finally, I was able to walk through the house without dreading the next breath. I walked around, surveying the damage my hallucinating mind had done, plus gauging how much cleaning would need to be done before it would be habitable again. It wasn't that bad, really. The dust wasn't even that thick. That would be easy to get rid of. There, see? Already one problem solved, and I hadn't been home 5 minutes yet. Owen followed me through the house. God, I said, this place is a mess.
Really? Owen joked. This isn't how you live all the time?
I stopped in the kitchen and turned to Owen. Well, I said, thanks for the ride home. I guess I can take it from here. I glanced around the room, seeing the dirt and dust. Looks like I've got a lot to do. Thanks again, Owen. I really appreciate it. I guess you probably saved my life. I wiggled my leg out in front of me. Thanks for fixing up the leg, too.
No problem, he said and smiled.
Tell your dad I said hi, and I'll talk to you later. He threw a quick glance around the kitchen, frowned, probably thanking God it wasn't him who had to straighten up this mess, then left. Before I could move, Owen returned. Sorry. I almost forgot I got you a welcome home present. He presented me with a new phone. Nothing fancy, it wasn't even cordless, but it beat two cans and a piece of string, which was about all I could afford.
Wow, thanks, I said.
Think nothing of it. I listened for the sound of the engine dying down as it got further away. I strolled into the office and sat down at my desk, placed the rolled-up sketches on the windowsill. Then I brought the portfolio out from under the desk, placed it on the desktop, and opened it. I took the rubber band off the sketches and placed them flat on the top page in the portfolio. I closed everything up and set it back on the floor by my feet. Then I got up and went to the living room. When I passed the kitchen phone, what was left of it, I stopped and stared at it. Man, I really didn't remember doing that. I seemed to remember the night I thought it happened. That was the night I ordered the pizza, and then the bugs came up from the basement. But I couldn't recall actually breaking the phone. Had I thrown it? Had it dropped? I couldn't remember. I passed into the living room and went to the couch. On the farthest cushion, closest to the door, was the notebook I'd been writing my dreams in. I didn't want to pick it up, but I had to. I was sure that opening that pad would be just as good as inviting the dreams to come back and...
And the man, Todd? Is that what you're thinking?
No, I was going to say that those dreams returning was something I didn't need right now. I had too many other things to waste my time doing, like changing this house from the dump it had become back to the nice, clean home it had been before. Nevertheless, I grabbed the pad. The pages crackled. They were crisp and seemed brittle, like they would break and fall to the floor in a small shower of white dust. I carried the pad to the office and set it on the floor next to the portfolio. Jack's voice came to me again.
What do you need that for, Todd? Why do you need any of that stuff? What did you sketch? Come on, tell me what you drew in the hospital. Do you know? With all that stuff under there, you look like you're getting ready for something. For what?
Go away, Jack. I pushed Jack away and went to the basement door. My fingers tightened around the handle. I had to go downstairs, but I didn't know if I would be able to make myself do it. I kept seeing the night the phone broke. Bugs had come up from there that night. There had been a lot of them. They lined the whole bottom of the door. I didn't want to go down there, but I had to. My fingers were turning white from the strain of squeezing the knob. I pried my hand off it before I pulled it out of the door. I took a few deep, relaxing breaths, closed my eyes, opened them again. I grabbed the handle again and opened the door. The darkness greeting me was so black as to seem almost obscene. I imagined a giant roach lurching out from the dark and I shivered. Quickly, before all nerve was lost, I curled a hand around the doorway and turned on the light. The stairway was illuminated and all thoughts of giant bugs vanished. I peered down, looking at the old, warped steps, the length of pipe that served as the rail. A droplet of sweat stood out on my forehead and slowly crept down the side of my face. I wiped it away absently and forced a foot out. The other foot was then pushed ahead of the first, and I moved down the step. My left hand curled around the rusted rail. I stood still for a second, waiting, wondering if there were any bugs inside the pipe. I continued down the stairs until I finally stepped onto the concrete. I looked around, searching the basement for a box. The other box marked, Work, to be exact. My eyes fell on it, and I pulled it out from the pile of other boxes, knelt, and opened it. There it was, my backpack, loaded with the colored pencils which had, in my dreams, turned to roaches. I reached in and brought the pack out, dangling and swinging and twirling in my hand like a mobile. I closed the box back up and hurried upstairs before the bugs could appear and claim me. I closed the door, then went into the office. I pulled the chair out and sat down. Then I leaned over and placed the backpack on the floor, leaning against the portfolio.
Hey, Todd, what's all that stuff for? You sure you're not preparing for something? You look like you're packing.
Fuck you, Jack. Jack obviously had no reply and kept his trap shut. I looked at my store of supplies, then got up and went into the living room.
I picked up the remote, laying on the table with a very fine coat of dust, pushed the power button, and listened to the electricity bring the television to life for the first time in half a month. The news was just beginning. Becky Dietrich was reminding everyone in town the August 1st parade, which would be held on the 4th, was rapidly approaching. The parade, I thought. After a second of consideration, I decided to attend. The day after I came home from the hospital, after I scanned and emailed the illustrations I'd finished, I began the tiresome job of cleaning the house. The dust wasn't as thick as I had first thought and came up quickly with a few swipes of a rag and a spray or two of Pledge. I swept the kitchen floor and vacuumed the living room, dining room, bedroom, and office. The only thing I had a hard time accepting was the windows. They were still painted over. I pondered the problem of the windows for a long time before realizing I had two options. Have them replaced or live with them. After thinking these solutions through more clearly, I realized that replacing them was really my only option. I didn't think my landlord would be too keen on the idea of painted windows, no matter what color they were. I thumbed through the phone book, found four glass shops in Angel Hill, and chose one, Angel Glass. I dialed the number on the new phone Owen had given me, stated my problem, and was given an estimate. The thought alone of the price was enough to make me consider asking Mr. Toms, the landlord, if it was kosher that I keep the colored glass. Then I realized I couldn't do that and set up an appointment for the windows to be replaced on the 7th of August, the soonest they would be able to do it. That was all right. The 7th was only about a week and a half away. I told them thank you and hung up. It's easy when you're living with your parents to think about how fun it'll be on your own. You're making money. You'll make out that budget they drill into your head in middle school. So much for living expenses, so much for food, so much for clothes, so much for entertainment. Those things are bogus, man. The real budget should read, so much for rent and utilities, living expenses, so much for food. If you get the combo in a large, it's only 15 cents more. What a bargain. So much for entertainment. The best DVDs are in the bargain bin anyway. And then forget the whole thing, because acts of God will fall down upon you and the car will need new brakes or the prescription will cost more than you thought. Or in a fit of madness, you'll spray paint all your windows and have to replace them because it's just so much easier than trying to scrape the paint back off. I really took Owen's advice to heart, and what he said to me in the hospital was a true inspiration. But heartfelt words don't pay bills, and for a second I thought again of getting a job. It wouldn't even have to be a big-time job. I could get something simple, a paper route, anything. It's not like I had a lot of off-hours responsibilities. I could draw my pictures when I get home. And then it hit me. Draw my pictures? What the fuck? That was work. I didn't draw pictures. I illustrated. I provided illustrations for small press novels. Shit, if bigger publishers illustrated their novels like the small presses do, I'd fight like hell to land those jobs too. It was serious, honest work. And if I ever again gave it that weak-ass tag, draw my pictures, I'd kick myself right in the nuts. Yes, I could get another job, but that's all it would be, because this was my real job. This was my work and my life. My father gave up his work and settled for a job. I would never do that. I couldn't. I could eat a horse, though. Holy fuck, I was starving. The hunger cramps had been gnawing at me for quite a while, but so far I had been able to stave them off. Now, I decided, would be a great time to get something in my stomach. I went to the kitchen, opened the refrigerator, and grimaced. It was nearly bare. There was a half carton of sour milk, two cans of Coke, a few Tupperware bowls half full of old spaghetti, and various other dinners I'd served myself since moving in. I grabbed one of the Cokes and went to the cabinets. They weren't much better off than the fridge. A couple cans of soup I didn't remember buying, I certainly didn't find them appealing, and a mouse-eaten box with cereal pouring from a hole in the corner. From the hole, I watched a small roach scurry out and go in some direction I didn't see because I had closed the cabinet shut with a quick snap. Again, I silently cursed Carl the fuckwad exterminator. Another hunger pain grabbed my attention. I resolved myself to going out to eat. Even though I hadn't started my car since the day before I broke my leg, I needed food and didn't have the kind of time it would take to buy it, get it home, then cook it. I would go shopping after my hunger had been sated. I slipped on my chucks, grabbed my wallet and keys. I went outside, locked the door behind me, and got in my car. It was a strange feeling, sliding behind the wheel of a car after being immobilized for so long. I briefly hoped I still remembered how to drive, then turned the key in the ignition. The car gave a short, breathy wheeze of non-use. I pumped the gas, then tried again. This time I got more than that wheeze. It was closer to a harsh mid-December raging blizzard cold cough, but it still didn't start. Shit, come on. I didn't just almost lose my sanity, then throw myself out an attic window, risking a broken neck to go along with my already broken leg, just to recover and then die of hunger in my car. Now start! Another pump of the gas, a quick prayer to God, and another turn of the key produced a cough, a roar, then a sound I had lost acquaintance with, the sound of the car's engine running. I sat there for a moment, wondering where that noise, that rumble, was coming from.
Then I realized the car had started. I smiled a little, then put the car in reverse and backed out onto the street. At first, I couldn't remember where the nearest fast food place was. Then it came to me. It was a local place called Jumbo's on 169. I tried to remember the way, but all my mind would focus on was the way the folks at Jumbo's made their hamburgers thicker and wider than most places. My mouth began to water, and the route to Jumbo's appeared in my head. I pulled away and headed toward a hamburger. During the drive, my mind drifted a little toward the dream I'd had the night before, my first night home. In it, I was 18 again and on the bus to the Fairfield State Hospital. Jack was sitting a few rows behind me in the back seat, turned around and looking out the back emergency exit door. My backpack sat next to me in the seat, full of books and assignments I hadn't turned in yet. I stared out the window and watched the city of Fairfield pass by. Suddenly, the bus came to a jerking stop. I looked up, wondering what was wrong, and saw the bus driver stand up. It wasn't the squirrely, hairy guy I was used to, the one who usually could be found talking about his motorcycles. This guy was small, but small in a different way. The normal guy, Terry, was thin and wiry. This driver was short and, well, just tiny. I watched him standing at the front of the bus. He wasn't moving, and then I noticed he wasn't the only one who seemed frozen in place. I looked around and saw that everyone on the bus was suspended in place. Hands hung in the air where they had been in mid-wave or some other motion. Expressions on people's faces remained still. Even a pencil that had been rolling down the aisle under the left-hand row of seats had stopped in its place. I looked at the statues in wonder. Why was everyone frozen? But I could move. And why was the statue of the bus driver staring at me? Suddenly, the short man by the door lever moved. Just a simple, tiny, almost imperceptible movement. And I hadn't seen it, just sensed it. I looked around. The driver was coming toward me, a strange, almost desperate look on his face. He got to my seat, leaned in close. I noticed the man's eyes carried a weird tint, making them seem almost red. He looked at me, stared at me. He opened his mouth as if to speak. Without warning or any premeditation, I leaped from the seat and yelled, "Why can't you just leave me alone? I can't help you. I can't bring the bugs and open the door. And once it is open, I won't be able to close it again." The man drew back. The look on his face changed from desperate to determined. "You have to do it, Todd," he said in a low, breathy voice. "It has to be you. You found me. You have to help me." "But I didn't find you. I just looked in the door. I heard you and wanted to know what you were saying. That's all." "But you were the only one. No one else heard." "That's not my fault." I felt the squirming in my bag before I had even finished my sentence, but I tried to ignore it. The man looked at the bag, saw the movement of the bugs in it, and said, "Todd, you can bring them, and you can help me." His desperation was back. "Please." Then the seams of the nylon bag ripped. I glimpsed the gigantic black bugs spilling forth before I had awakened, sweating and holding my leg, expecting to feel the rough texture of the cast. Now, lost in my remembrance, I almost ran my poor, dilapidated car into a tree. I snapped awake, brought the car to a screeching halt less than a foot from the trunk of the tree, put it in neutral, and sat there for a few moments with my eyes closed. I had my hands pressed against my eyes, and when I brought them away, I think I was crying.
"It's supposed to be over," I said through gasps and hitches. "The pills are gone. The hallucinations. Those dreams, too. They were gone."
When I calmed down enough to see the road clearly, I turned the car around and headed for the grocery store. I wasn't hungry anymore, but I knew I would be later, so I'd better stock up. I pushed my cart of purchases into the first available checkout. The cashier was an older woman, maybe in her late 40s or early 50s. Her hair, which I could tell had been dyed so many times the woman herself may not remember its natural color, was piled high atop her head in a beehive. She was wearing a very loud green blouse with a brooch on the left breast, similar to the one my grandmother used to have before she died of a stroke. I unloaded my items from the cart, a case of Coke, some frozen dinners, a couple of canned things with Italian names and tomato sauce. Before going to the checkout, I had stopped by the stationery aisle and tossed four packages of colored pencils into the cart. I glanced to the right and saw a thick magazine with a picture of Prince Charles with a Martian hand growing out of his forehead. I picked it from the rack and added it on impulse. I paid by debit and stood silently as the sacker, a thin, gangly teen with acne worse than the pizza boy a few weeks earlier, stuffed everything into two plastic bags. Then the boy set the sacks and the Coke in my cart and pushed them out to my car. Before reaching the door, I happened to glance back over my shoulder at the cashier. I stumbled and choked back a gasp. The woman had somehow been replaced by a short, balding, bespectacled man with red eyes that bore into my skin, crawled under there, and explored the dark terrain inside my body. I shivered, looked at the man at the register, then felt the sacker tapping my shoulder. I looked around and saw the kid standing there by the automatic doors with an impatient look tattooed across his face. "You want to show me where I'm supposed to take these?" "Oh, yeah," I stammered.
Before crossing the threshold, I threw one more quick glance over my shoulder and saw the old woman, big hair and all, running a can of coffee across the scanner. I watched the cricket make its way across the floor before turning and leading the already annoyed Sacker to my car. When the teen saw the shape of my car, he snickered, and when I asked what was so funny, the kid decided to banish all tact and say, "Nice car. What did you do, ram it into a few walls, then drop some boulders on it?" In response, I said, "Man, I can't believe you didn't get Employee of the Month. You were robbed." Before the boy could go back into the store, I stopped him and perplexed him further by suddenly asking, "Are there any bugs in those sacks?" The kid looked at me as if I were a raving lunatic, then turned and trotted back to the safety and sanity of the bright overhead lights. I woke up on the morning of August 4th, pissed, brushed my teeth, and dressed. I scanned the morning paper for the information I was looking for and found it on the first page of the metro section. August 1st parade on 4th. The parade route started at the corner of 10th and Henry, then ran the entire length of the former, up around what was known in Angel Hill as the Garden, curving around Daisy Avenue and Rose Drive, to Gray Street, and stopping on 1st Street. The parade started in an hour. I tried to remember how to get to 10th from my street, as I grabbed my keys and a light jacket and headed out the door. It was August in Missouri, and I didn't need a jacket. Would probably regret it later, in fact. But it had my pencils in the pocket. Over the past few days, I had taken to carrying colored pencils everywhere I went. Not that I had a roaring social life, but the few times I did leave the house, the pencils went with me. I couldn't say why, but they made me feel safer, like a security blanket. They were in the right front pocket, and I kept my hand curled around them. Not the whole package, just two or three. Once in a while, Jack would try to inject his 2 cents worth.
"Todd, why do you need a security blanket? Afraid the man and his bugs are going to come back? Don't worry. Those were just hallucinations, remember? Or are you finally getting a clue?"
"I hope so. I'd hate to see something bad happen and you find yourself unprepared." Usually I ignored the forgotten jock, but sometimes when Jack spoke of preparing and bad things happening, I found the power to resist listening harder and harder, and I felt small shivers running along my spine. I got in my car and backed out. I saw Mr. Roman's head bob up and down behind the hedges that separated our yards. He was on his knees, doing something or other to his yard. I offered a hello, but Mr. Roman turned the other way as if he hadn't heard. I thought maybe he really hadn't heard, but another part of me, Jack's part perhaps, thought maybe Mr. Roman had decided, after having to call the hospital on the guy next door, he simply wanted nothing to do with me. Who could blame him? I pulled away in search of 10th Street. I finally found the street after stopping in 2 gas stations and an inquiry for directions from a guy walking his dog along the sidewalk 45 minutes later. I found a parking spot 4 blocks away and walked to the street, shouldering my way through the crowd that was gathered there. After a few minutes of standing waiting for the first signs of the parade to appear, I turned to the man next to me. "Excuse me, do you have any idea what this parade is all about?" The man looked at me dumbfounded. "Sorry," I said. "I just moved here a few months ago."
"Oh," the man said. "Well, I'm not sure how it got started, but it's just sort of a tradition."
"Oh, well, do you know what it's for?"
"Not really," the man said. "I think it had something to do with the town's founders."
"So why do they call it the August 1st parade if it's not on August 1st?
"That's the day it used to be on. After a while, they just started having it on the first Saturday of the month."
"Oh," I murmured, and turned back to the street, searching for the parade. The streets and sidewalks were lined with people trying to see over the people in front of them. After a while, the first float passed by, followed by the roaring cheer of the assembled masses of Angel Hill. I watched, fascinated by the spectacle of all these people enjoying the same event at the same time. More floats, most of which were directed at the idea of nothing but having fun, went by. Seeing all this joy and revelry, I wondered how could a place like this produce the stories I grew up hearing from Owen. He had a kid come in once, he said, not too long ago, who had an MRI done, and when the scan was done, it looked like the kid had 2 brains. Not 2 brains crammed together in his skull, but the image of 2 brains, one overlapping the other, like a ghost image. Owen said he read later that family's house had burned to the ground, and when he saw where they lived, he shivered and thought about the double image. They'd lived in this big 3-story house on 4th Street that had always been the official haunted house of Angel Hill, and had had a story about it published in a book of Angel Hill stories, and Owen said when he learned that was their house, and he remembered the scan, he had a second where he wondered if that house might have had something to do with the image. I've never understood whether Owen believes the stories about this town or if he just pretends to believe them when he's telling us. If he really believes them, I've heard some to make me wonder what the hell he's still doing here. But then you see something like this, all these people gathered here enjoying this thing they've created in celebration of their town, and you think what a nice place this is to be. There were trucks decorated and streamers sporting the names of local bars like Scandals and the Oak Tree Tavern and Bill's Place.
Some of the cars had the names of high schools and badly drawn mascots, even though those schools wouldn't be in session for another couple of weeks. A flatbed truck drove by carrying a local band. The sides of the truck sported the band's name, Lost Cause. I heard someone in the crowd say they were from Kansas City. I listened for a minute, then decided they weren't half bad. After the flatbed and Lost Cause, I glanced around at the people in the crowd. I'd begun to lose interest in the parade and wished I had Owen or Brian here to keep me company. The mood was still there, but how many floats can you really watch drive by you at 2 miles an hour and still be interested? I looked to the right, down the street, watching the approaching trucks, cars, and other decorated vehicles, looking for something to concentrate on until it passed. There was nothing that seemed too different than the rest of the floats I had seen so far. Then I looked up to the left. There was nothing there either, just the part of the parade I had already seen and a huddle of old buildings. I didn't know what they were and could only barely make out the letters on the fronts. I did see an old, blackened, and fallen building I assumed was a library that had burned down. I remembered seeing it on the news.
That was before the man, Jack reminded me.
Thanks, Jack. I know that, I said aloud. The man I had talked to earlier now turned to look at me.
Pardon?
He asked. Oh, nothing, I said. Just talking to myself.
That's what crazy people do, the man joked and chuckled, turning back to the parade.
I wanted to take out one of my pencils and stab him. Instead, I settled on sticking my hand in my pocket and tumbling the pencils over and over in it. When I went back to the parade, I watched bewildered. Coming up the street, I saw a big white van with the words Fairfield State Hospital stenciled up the sides in faded pink letters I thought might have, at one time, been red. I was motionless as the van approached. The closer it got, the more it drowned out the noise of the crowd. It was next to me, then in front of me, then past me. It seemed to be going in slow motion, taking its time driving by. The sound of its engine rang in my ears, and there was another sound. I looked for it, but it was nowhere to be seen. When the truck was finally passed, I looked in through the back door, which was a metal grate, and saw the man in the window sitting against the mesh. His straitjacket was on, his hair was messy, and his eyes were burning. The sound I had been trying to place was the sound of the man's voice calling, "Bugs! Bugs! 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 Bugs!" I watched, dumbstruck, as the van got lost in the crowd, then disappeared. I searched for it, but it was nowhere. I jumped up, trying to see over the big head in front of me. I tried to dodge through the masses and follow it, but it was simply gone. I turned around and tried to find the man I talked to earlier. My hand was in my pocket, tumbling the pencils as I ducked around and under arms, trying not to get hit in the face. When I thought I'd found him, I pointed toward the street and the passing parade and asked, "Did you see that van go by?" When I turned to face the man for an answer, I wound up face to face with the balding, burning-eyed man from my hallucinations. I turned the pencils over and over in my pocket. Jack decided this would be a good time to speak up.
"Hey, Todd, are you going to start listening for a change? I've been trying to tell you something's missing from Owen's equation. I know I flunked algebra, but I still know that much. Do you know what it is, Todd? I'll tell you. The pills."
Understanding dawned in my mind, and I thought,
"Jesus, that's right. I didn't even realize it."
I turned from the man I had tried unsuccessfully to be rid of for over a month now and ran. The limp in my leg announced itself, and my run had to look funny to anyone who saw it. But I ran nonetheless. I ran until I was able to plop behind the wheel of my car and get away. When I got home, I locked myself in the house, sat on the couch, then leaned over with my elbows on my knees and my open palms to my eyes, and wept. After about 30 minutes of sobbing and thinking, pondering the past month, I wiped a hand across my eyes, stood, and limped to the office. I sat behind the desk, watched a bug scurry out from under the trash can and disappear behind the stereo. Then leaned over and brought out the things I had put.
"You stashed them, Todd. I told you you were preparing."
There onto the desktop. As I sat there, looking at the things, I noticed a scraping sound. It was like a million consecutive taps. I peered over the top of the desk into the bathroom and saw the bugs. There was an army of them gathering at the edge of the bathroom floor. I didn't know where they had come from, and I really didn't want to know. I stared at them, too petrified to move. Soon, they began to edge closer to the doorway. I was still. Slowly, I moved my hands to cover the things on the desk, as if to protect them. I lifted myself from the chair and stood full length. The bugs didn't move. I stared at them, and they seemed to be staring back. They edged a little closer. I picked up the backpack with the pencils and hurled it at them. But before it hit, the bugs were gone. I walked to the doorway slowly, cautiously. I stooped and hooked a finger around one of the straps. It felt heavier than it had a second ago. I stood and looked at the backpack, then nodded, finally understanding the rules of this strange game I had been chosen to play. While Hedda took us down that hallway, pointing out the doors and telling us stories, she stopped at one and said,
"The story here is one of my favorites. Before the man in this room came here, he'd been sick for a long time.
He'd contracted a disease, something that left him paralyzed and in bed. He developed bed sores, and the sores had been infected by bugs and eggs laid in them. Alone and scared for his life, he had made a deal with the devil. He sold himself to save himself. And it worked, in a way, because the disease vanished. The sores healed. But in his excitement at being healed, the man was bounding down the stairs to face the world again. He slipped and fell and was found by his nurse, who was downstairs, on the floor, ranting about the devil and bugs. He was taken to the Fairfield Hospital, where it was determined the fall had caused some brain damage, and the story he was telling about the devil was just a figment of a fractured imagination. He was brought here, where he stayed until he died several years later. And to this day, the room's not been used. Even the mentally disturbed don't want to stay in there. I'm sure Mr. James will have quite a discussion on all this when you get back to the classroom.
Or something like that. I'm sure those weren't her exact words, but you get the point. And now that I think about it years later, wasn't she violating some kind of patient confidentiality by telling us about all those patients? Then again, she never mentioned any names, and we never saw anyone, so maybe not. However, my memory of that day is obviously not what I thought it was. It seems when I remember the trip, I hadn't remembered all of it. And I could sit and wonder all day how I could remember looking into the slot, but not remember Hedda telling us about him. But if I'm going to do that, I might as well wonder how the hell I could forget any of it in the first place. Well, I remembered now, and with the remembering, understanding, and with that, a purpose. I had just tossed my backpack onto the passenger seat of my car next to a small suitcase when Owen pulled up in front of my house.
"Where are you going?" he asked, stepping out.
"Can't talk now, Owen," I said. "I've got to go."
"I see that. But where are you going?"
I thought it was weird he would show up like that, out of the blue, just as I was leaving to do what I had to do.
"And why are you in such a hurry?"
"I really don't have time to talk about this, but I promise, if I get back, I'll tell you everything, from beginning to end."
"Wait a minute," Owen said. "What do you mean, if you get back?"
"I know where I'm going, and I know why, but I don't know what's going to happen when I get there. And since I don't know that, I can't predict how it's going to turn out. However, I do hope I get to tell you all about it. Now, please, I have to get going." Owen's face said he was beginning to get a little more than concerned. He was, in fact, bordering frightened. He walked to the driver's side of the car and stood in front of the door, barring my entrance.
"Owen, what are you doing?"
"Keeping you here until you tell me where you're going."
"I'm a big boy. I can take care of myself."
"Yeah, you've been doing a bang-up job so far, haven't you?"
He rubbed a hand in the dent on top of my car.
"You know why that happened," I said.
"Yeah, I do. However, just because everyone else who's off the Dietril seems fine, that doesn't mean they're going to stay that way. Side effects have to start with someone."
"This isn't a side effect. It's something I have to take care of. It's something I have to do. Now please, move so I can go."
"Where?"
"Move."
"Where, Todd?"
I sighed and looked around. I watched a kid on a skateboard speed down the hill and wondered if he would stop before coming to the intersection a few houses away from mine. I didn't keep watching long enough to find out. Instead, I looked in Owen's eyes and said,
"Fairfield."
"You're going to see your parents?" he asked, relieved.
"No."
"Well, if I get out of this, I'll probably stop by and see them. But no, that's not where I'm going." Owen was becoming concerned again. I could see it in his face. He was afraid he knew where I was headed, but that vocalizing it would make it a reality. And that was a reality he didn't want to face.
"Todd, tell me you're just going to the city of Fairfield and not that hospital."
"Fine, I'm not going to the hospital."
"Thank God."
The relief in his voice was obvious. "So, what are you going to Fairfield for if it's not to see your mom and dad?"
"I have to go to the hospital," I said, not taking my eyes from Owen's.
"Jesus, Todd, you just said you weren't going there."
"It was what you wanted to hear."
"Yes, I lied, but that's what you wanted." I put my hand in my jacket pocket and tumbled the pencils over and over, faster and faster.
"Owen, you knew that's where I was going, but you wanted to hear me say it wasn't. So, you heard it. Now move so I can go."
"No." "Owen, I'm not asking you."
"And I'm not moving. Tell me why you're going there."
The pencils tumbled over and over, clicking together in my pocket.
"He's back,"
I said, my voice cracking as if I were experiencing puberty all over again.
"The old man?"
I nodded. Owen shook his head.
"I told you, Todd, those were hallucinations brought on by swelling of the brain from the Dietril. I thought you understood that. I thought you were over it, that they were out of your system. Shit, it's been almost a month since I got you off of them."
"Owen," I said in a low voice, moving in closer, "I had stopped taking the Dietril long before you found me. In fact, I don't think I took 3 pills the whole time that man was visiting me. I had forgotten about that.
but he reminded me.
Who did? The old man?
No. Guy I knew in high school.
When did you talk to him?
I'm always talking to him. He's up here now.
I tapped my temple with my index finger. Owen got a strange look in his eyes. Are you going crazy, Todd? I shook my head and sighed again. I hope to God I'm not, I said. I can't stop you, can I?
No.
Well then, Owen said, clasping his hands together and rubbing them, let me come with you. I considered this thought for a moment. I couldn't see how a little help would hurt anything, but I still said,
I don't know.
I'll let you go, but you have to let me come too.
You'll let me go?
I laughed. Well, thank you for your kindness and generosity, but actually, I'm going whether you let me or not.
Then I'm coming too.
Fine, I said. Whatever you want. Just get in and let's get going. I don't want to waste any more time than I have to. You've already made me waste enough. Owen started to get in, then said, would it be better if we took my car? It's probably a lot more capable of getting us there.
No, I said. I'm taking my car.
Geez, Mr. Independent, he said, then got in, tossing the suitcase and backpack into the back seat.
Hey, be careful with that. Valuables in there.
Sorry, Owen said. What is it? He held the backpack up even with his face, trying to judge the contents by its shape and weight.
Pencils. Bugs. I don't know. Both, maybe.
Right, Owen said. I backed my car out of the driveway and pulled away, heading for Fairfield. Halfway between Angel Hill and Fairfield, on County Road B, Owen asked if I was okay.
Sure, I said. Why?
You just look sort of... He shrugged. I don't know. Determined.
I am, I said without taking my eyes off the road.
Would it be okay if you told me what you're going there for?
I thought for a second, then reached down and turned the radio, which had been spouting nothing but static and the occasional song, off.
I cleared my throat, then said, remember that story I told you about when I was in high school?
Yeah, Owen said.
You told it to me the day they took you to the hospital that second time, after you jumped out the window.
Yeah. Well, I thought that, being off the Dietrile, those things would go away again. I thought I'd be able to forget all about them. The thing is, it wasn't over. None of it.
I laughed at the look of confusion on his face. What isn't over? He asked. I looked at the road. I was trying to decide how to say it, where to start, how to word it. Finally, I glanced at Owen, who was watching me, and began. It wasn't the Dietrile.
But how do you know?
I wasn't taking them anymore. Like I said at the house, I had stopped taking them before he showed up. He was with me for a while, and my leg didn't hurt anymore, so I didn't need them. Maybe that's how he got in. He might have started as a hallucination, but he was more than that. And when you told me that's what caused them, I was just so glad to have an explanation. I didn't think about the fact that I hadn't had a pill in a couple of weeks. I reached my right arm behind me, waving it in the air behind the seat. I was searching for my notebook. It was standing upright behind the backpack.
What are you looking for?
My notebook, I said.
I'll get it. You watch the road.
Thanks, I said, taking the pad in one hand, keeping the wheel steady in the other, and flipping the cover open. I started having these strange dreams. They were like a movie, and every night I'd see a little more of it. I didn't realize then that they were the same dream as I was writing them down. I was skimming through this yesterday and saw things I don't remember having written. Trying to keep the car on a road, I found the dream about the game show. I handed the spiral to Owen and said, here, read this one. He read it quickly, then looked at me.
What is this?
That's what this is all about.
A game show? One where the devil is the MC?
No, you're taking it too literally. You have to get past all the detail and just look at the general idea of the dream.
Which is?
Owen looked at me as if he thought maybe I really was losing it.
He needs me.
Who? The bald man?
The man in the window, I said, nodding.
He was just a man you saw when you took a field trip in high school. He's not even there anymore. They closed that hospital, remember?
Whether he's there or not is not the point. I'm pretty sure he's dead by now. He probably was the first time I saw him, but it's not his body that needs saving.
Oh, so you're going to save his soul? From what?
I kept my eyes on the road and didn't say anything.
Owen, why did you come along?
I grew up listening to you and your Angel Hill stories about what a weird place it is and all the stuff that's gone on there. If you didn't believe the stories, why tell them to me? And if you did believe them, why can't you believe this? Because it's not happening in Angel Hill and therefore it can't be real?
Let me tell you something. I've lived there now how many months? And I've yet to see anything like what you've always talked about. Except this man. So if you can't believe in this, why did you come along?
I had caught him off guard. He sat there, speechless for a second. Then he said,
I was hoping to talk you out of this.
I shot him a look.
You can't. You're talking about kids' fantasies. Heaven and hell? God and Satan? What are you doing?
They're hallucinations brought on by an experimental drug. And all the Angel Hill stories?
He shrugged. Well, yeah, I told you the stories. I wasn't giving you hard scientific evidence or explanations for them. I was just telling you what I'd heard. True or not isn't the point there, because they're just stories, just things people tell each other, legends about a town where people like to think there's something special. But you go anywhere and you're going to hear stories. Not like the ones you've told.
Okay, so Angel Hill's stories are more elaborate than other places. But those stories don't make you throw a bag full of pencils into the car and take off for an abandoned mental hospital. You think your parents are going to bail us out? I'm not coming along because I think you're in danger from the boogeyman. I just want you to realize what you're doing and how absurd it is.
Shit!
I yelled and jerked the wheel to the left, sending the car swerving into the other lane. What was that? Owen asked when I finally had the car under control again. I slammed on the brake. The car screeched to a stop, sliding onto the gravel shoulder. I unbuckled the seatbelt and turned around in my seat, looking out the back window. I almost hit him, I said. He was there, right in the middle of the road. Owen looked, but there was nothing, not even traffic. I knew we should have taken my car, and I should have driven. Just before I swerved, I thought, for a second, that I had seen something in the middle of the road. I didn't see it well, but it was taller than an animal. And it wasn't very clear, like I was seeing it through a glazed pane of glass. As I pulled away, I looked back again and saw a glint in the distance, back where we had gone off the road. It was like a sun glimmer, or a reflection of the sun off something, like maybe a pair of glasses.
I told you we should have taken my car, Owen said for the second time, getting out into the sunlight.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I looked at the gas gauge again. It was well past empty. If you were going out of town, why didn't you make sure you had plenty of gas to get there? I haven't driven in over 2 months. After that long, I guess I just didn't think about it. It was 20 miles between Angel Hill and Fairfield. We only had another 4 miles to go. I got out, reached into the back seat, and grabbed my backpack and suitcase. Then Owen and I set off in the direction of Fairfield on foot. I looked back at the car once and thought of corpses. After 15 minutes, Owen asked again, "Why didn't you make sure you had gas?"
"I told you. Besides," I said, "it probably wouldn't have made a difference. Something else would have gone wrong."
"How do you know?"
"Because whatever it is that's keeping this man, the devil, whatever, it doesn't want us there. I had no doubts it would be tough getting there. This is just a test. But we have to have faith and press on."
"You're gone," Owen said, looking into the field to our right. "You are absolutely gone."
We passed a sign that told us we only had 3 miles to go.
3 miles. That shouldn't take too long if we keep up the pace.
My leg was getting tired and the limp was beginning to announce itself.
"Are you sure that leg is going to make it?"
"No problem," I said, then trotted a little to prove my point. The only thing we saw on the way to town, except for miles of fields growing nothing, was a farmhouse. The lights were off and there were no cars in the driveway.
"I'd hate to live out here in the middle of nowhere," Owen said. "No neighbors, no one to talk to. Think of the boredom."
I had enough of the solitary life. As we passed, I looked out into the field behind the house and stopped walking. Owen took 5 more steps before he realized he was the only one moving. He came back to where I stood, staring into the dead field.
"What?" he asked, trying to figure out what I was so interested in.
I pointed.
"There,"
I said, "on that grassy knoll."
"What?" Owen said, annoyed. "Are you seeing Lee Harvey now?"
"No," I replied simply. "Look."
Owen had to squint in order to focus, but he finally was able to make out the shape on the small hill. A figure standing upright, its arms out straight to the sides.
"It's a scarecrow, Todd."
"Are you sure?"
"Look at it. What else do you think it is?"
In response, I simply looked at Owen, then looked back into the field. I set down the backpack and suitcase and began to go toward it.
"Todd, come on. If we get there soon enough, we might get your father to take us back tonight. I do have to be at the hospital tomorrow morning."
Owen's pleas went unheard. I was concentrating on a small figure crucified in the field. In my pocket, my hand twirled the pencils around and around. I could hear the tap they made when they hit each other. I wasn't so sure it was a scarecrow. I didn't know what to expect when I got to it, but I was positive it was more than a jumble of old clothes tied together and stuffed with straw. Maybe it would be the man in the window. I stepped over a ditch at the edge of the road and entered the yard. I walked down the hill, by the house, and barely noticed a crow that zipped past my head. The bird landed in the old field and watched me. Don't think I didn't recognize the significance. I've read enough horror fiction to know a death omen when I see one. I kept looking at the figure, trying to make it out, but I couldn't. Every time I thought I had it, the strain from concentrating made my eyes burn and my head pound. Another crow flew by, landing a few feet from the first. My eyes stayed on the figure. Owen stood in the road, watching me go down the hill and approach the scarecrow. I finally got to the thing on the post, and for a second I did see the man in the window.
He was tied to it with his arms straight out at his sides, his head down and his thin hair hanging in his face. The straitjacket was still on, but had been unclasped. The man's glasses were off, and I wondered where they were. I looked at his face, trying to gauge his condition by the look on it, but I couldn't. His eyes were closed. Then the scene blinked out and the man was replaced by an actual scarecrow. It was clad in faded overalls that had been patched in half a dozen places, and a long white shirt that was now muddy brown. It looked like a dirty straitjacket. Its head hung down from a badly assembled neck, and strands of straw fell down across its face. I let out the breath I'd been holding and closed my eyes. I opened them again and turned around. Then I headed back for the road and Owen. I hobbled up the hill, then stepped over the ditch. My leg was getting worse the longer we walked. "It was just a scarecrow," I said. I bent at the waist and picked up the backpack and suitcase when Owen said, "It's not doing a very good job." "What?" I asked. "I said it's not doing a very good job of scaring the crows." I looked around, behind us, over us. I hadn't noticed them until Owen said something, but we were surrounded by crows. The wires above us on either side of the road were lined with them. There were crows standing in a clump in the middle of the road leading back to Angel Hill, and ahead of us leading to Fairfield. They were staring at us. "No," I thought. "Not Owen and me. Just me. I don't even think they realize he's here." Todd? Owen said quietly, trying not to attract any more attention than we were already getting. "What are they doing?" "Waiting." "Mind telling me for what?" "I told you, it doesn't want us to get there. It doesn't want me to get there." "Are they going to attack us?" I took a few steps forward, but stopped before reaching the circle of birds. A few of them moved toward me, menacingly, their dark eyes watching me, daring me to break the circle. A few birds squawked as if saying, "We dare you." I tried to move, but as soon as I got too close, two of them leaned in and pecked my ankle.
"Ow! Shit!"
I yelled and leaped back. One of them flew from the power line and swept my head. I saw Owen duck as if it had been his head that was dive-bombed. I thought for a second, ambling carefully around a small circle of road we had. They wouldn't let me through. I knew that. Owen maybe. But he didn't believe in what I was doing, so letting him through wouldn't get the job done. I slid the pack off my shoulders again and handed it and the suitcase to Owen. "Here, take these." "What are you giving me this for?" "They're going to try to stop me if I try to get through. But it's not you they want, so you can get through them." "Todd, they'd be all over me as soon as I stepped toward them." I shook my head, then looked at the crows and back to Owen. "I don't think so. But if they do attack, you can run a lot better than I can."
"So I'm bait?"
I shrugged.
"We'll see what happens."
He gave me a look.
"Hey, I'd be lying if I said it was a sure thing, but I can't think of anything else."
I paused, trying to word the next instruction as tactfully as I could to keep from scaring him. "I'm going to toss you my jacket, and then I want you to run."
"Why the jacket?"
I shook the pocket, and the colored pencils in it clicked together. Owen shook his head with a look on his face that said, "I can't believe this is happening." I helped him into the backpack, then he started for the crows. He was at the perimeter when he stopped and looked back. I stood in the middle of them, helpless without my things. There seemed to be a spotlight on me there in the middle of the birds. Owen turned and stepped into them. There was a brief moment when I thought the one at his ankle was about to start pecking. Instead, it only glanced in his direction, then turned back to me. Owen took a second step and barely missed stepping on one of them. I stood in the circle and watched him. I put a hand in my pocket again and this time began to rub the pencils like a magic lamp. I hoped it would bring luck good enough to get us through this. Owen was almost through. He gripped the suitcase tight enough to make his knuckles turn white. He was just about out of the clump of birds at this end of the road. He watched them to make sure they weren't coming after him yet. He wanted to put off that part of my plan as long as possible. He looked over his shoulder. I was still standing there, motionless, except to breathe. We were both sweating. Owen looked at his feet and realized the next step would take him over the last bird and out of this black circle. He quickly stepped over the bird and exhaled a sigh of relief. He turned around, slid the pack to the ground, and dropped the suitcase. He kept his eyes on me. The space between us was only about 10 feet. I took off my jacket. I was reluctant to give up my pencils, but I knew keeping them would defeat the purpose. No matter what I was wearing, if I had the pencils, they would be able to find me. That's why I had to give them to Owen. I rolled the jacket up around the pocket the pencils were in and tossed it. Owen put it on and looked at the birds. They were all looking around now, as if lost. They went from looking at me to watching Owen. They looked as if they were trying to come to an important decision. Good, I thought. Keep them confused until we're out of their circle. The first birds to take flight and give chase were the ones on the power line. They swooped down and buzzed Owen's ear, close enough for him to hear and feel the swoosh of air they cut. He ducked and looked up at them. The crows in the road were next. He felt a sharp prick at his ankle and looked down. Then another. His feet were almost covered with crows and they were pecking at him, trying to pick the flesh off his legs. He jumped up quickly, shaking most of them off.
Then he grabbed the backpack and suitcase and ran toward Fairfield. I tried to keep up, but I knew it wasn't going to happen, so I jogged along as best I could, happy the birds weren't attacking me, but sorry for Owen that he had to play bait to save my skin.
"I'll make it up to you," I thought, and continued jogging.
I came to a hill and looked up at it. It wasn't that steep or very long, but I was tired, and I thought my leg was about to announce a revolution, detach itself, and spend the rest of its life lying around and resting its muscles. I stopped running for a second, bent, and placed my palms on my thighs. I caught my breath and rubbed the sore muscles in my no longer broken leg. Then I took off up the hill again. It was longer and steeper than I first thought, but thinking of Owen being eaten alive by a flock of crows made me try harder to get to the top. When I finally did reach the crest of the hill, I saw Owen at the bottom, standing at the side of the road, swinging the backpack wildly at the birds that flew about him. I joined, but didn't know what to do. I didn't have anything to swing at them. Feeling guilty about my uselessness, I unzipped the backpack halfway and reached my hand in, hoping to find pencils, but knowing I was plunging my hand into roaches. I grabbed a handful of colored pencils and brought them out. The birds were spiraling around us, threatening to dive at any moment. I turned so my back was to Owen, drew my hand back, and threw the pencils at the birds. The pencils left my hand. I saw them. They were pencils when I threw them, but they were bugs that made contact with the birds. It was only two birds I hit, but they served as an example to the rest. The two bugs were soon 10, then 20, and in seconds both birds were so heavy with bugs they fell out of the sky. They lay in the road trying to get up and fly, but they were smothered in bugs. One of them was completely surrounded and I watched, wondering how long it would take before the bird was dead. My question was answered, for the bug scampered off the bird, leaving only a skeleton and a few feathers, and into the grass at the side of the road. The other bird wasn't devoured, the bugs left its head intact. One black eye looked skyward, as if begging for help.
Seeing this, or maybe just sensing the danger to them, the rest of the crows ended their assault and flew off toward the sun, leaving a few stragglers to make one last attempt. Owen swung and hit one out of the sky. The others got the message, turned in the air, and tried to catch up to the others. Owen panted from exertion and collapsed on the ground. I was on my knees. Breathlessly, Owen said, "What the fuck was that?"
I turned toward him and said, "An attempt to keep us away from Fairfield and the hospital."
"Well, it's working pretty good so far,"
he tried to scream. His throat was dry from panting and his head dripped sweat. He tried to stand but faltered at the first attempt. He looked down and saw blood running from his ankle.
"Oh, shit," he groaned.
I stood up, tried to bend my leg, and moaned. "You believe me now? Are you convinced?" Owen regarded me with a pissed look and mumbled something I couldn't hear.
"Come on," he said, handing me the backpack.
"We're almost there." We walked in silence for a while. Once, I looked to my left and saw the man walking with us. I knew Owen wouldn't see him, so I kept the man's presence to myself. The sun began to fade and the sky was turning gray.
"What do you think will happen when we get there?" Owen asked.
"I don't know. Besides, I thought you had already declared me insane."
"I had, but..."
He didn't know how to say what was on the tip of his tongue.
"What?"
"Well, it's kind of hard not to believe when a flock of crows appears from nowhere and tries to eat you alive. And where did those cockroaches come from? Besides, I see him too, Todd. He's been there for a while now. At first I thought it was just exhaustion from the walking or delirium from the heat, but he's been there half an hour, and he's keeping pace with us." We walked on. A half hour later, we passed the sign that read, "Fairfield, Missouri City Limits. Population, 40,000. There was still some light left, and the two of us were beat.
"We should get some sleep," Owen said. "Do whatever needs doing in the morning."
I stared at him and said, "No, this guy's been waiting a long time for me, for us, to help him. We're here now. We'll do it now."
"Todd, if it's been that long, another day ain't going to kill him."
"It's not the extra day he's afraid of. It's whatever's got him, keeping him in that room, in that jacket, that terrifies him. Now, I'm going tonight. I didn't ask you to come along, so if you want to get off here, feel free."
I walked away, leaving Owen alone.
With the dark closing in, he trotted up to me and said,
"Okay, let's get it over with."
"You sure?" I asked. Reluctantly, he nodded. That's the Owen I knew. Cool, collected, in charge. Of all the adults I've ever met in my life, Owen's always been my favorite.
We walked for another 30 minutes before coming to the outside gate of the Fairfield State Hospital.
"Jesus Christ, what happened to this place?" Owen asked.
"Budget cuts, I think," I explained. "Or something. I don't know."
We stood outside the front gate, looking up the estate at the hospital. It was dilapidated and huge.
"It looks like those Dracula movies they used to make," Owen said.
"I just wanted to get inside."
The trees, all of which were dead and rotting, kept the moonlight out of the estate and kept the ground dark.
"Did you happen to bring a flashlight?" Owen asked.
"Uh-huh."
"Good. Now, how are we supposed to get over this gate?"
I looked at it, following it up to the top. It was too tall to try and climb. We would have to go through it. I walked until I found the entrance. As I expected, it was padlocked. I set the suitcase on the ground and opened it. I felt around inside for a second, then brought out a flashlight and a crowbar. I handed the flashlight to Owen.
"Thanks," he said.
"Shine it on the chain," I instructed. He clicked the light on and aimed the beam at the chain and lock. Then I used the crowbar to force the lock and open the gate. It opened with a whining creak, and Owen shivered. The creak made my leg tingle. When the gate was open, we slid past it and were on the hospital grounds. It was darker than it had looked from outside. Owen waved the flashlight back and forth, waiting for a caretaker or someone else to come and tell us we were trespassing, but no one came.
"The front door is this way,"
I whispered, pointing ahead.
"You're going to the front door?" Owen asked.
"Yeah, why? What's wrong with the front door?"
"Nothing," Owen said. "Just seems a little obvious, doesn't it?
You'd rather I sneak in through a basement window? They know we're here."
We walked around in the dark, Owen waving the beam back and forth in our path until we reached the door. It was glass, but the dust and whatever else that covered it made it look as if it were just a rectangle of shiny wall. A crack ran across the pane, cutting a jagged path from one side to the other. I clenched my fist tight around the crowbar and drew my arm back, about to swing. Before I could let go, I felt a hand on my elbow.
"What if there's an alarm?"
I swung the crowbar into the glass with all the force I could muster. There was a loud smack against the glass, but it didn't break. I looked at the door, dumbfounded. Then I swung again, this time aiming for the crack. Again, the glass remained strong. I was getting upset. All this way, half of it on foot, almost being devoured by crows, and I couldn't handle breaking an already cracked pane of glass with a crowbar?
"It's still trying to keep us out," I said.
"But you can break it, Todd," Jack said.
"Yes," I thought back. "I know I can. I know I have to." I traded Owen the crowbar for the backpack. "Stand back," I said. Owen moved back a couple of steps and watched. I held the backpack straps in both hands, stood with my legs a few feet apart, brought it back behind my shoulders. I felt like a baseball player with a weird stance. I took a deep breath, my face tightened with my lips pressed together. Then I swung and shut my eyes tight when the glass shattered. When the sound of the glass hitting the ground finally died away, I set the backpack on the ground. I looked at the shards on the entryway floor in the dark, some on the steps outside the door. I thought how good I had gotten at breaking glass since all this started. I looked back at Owen, who was standing a few feet behind me, a perplexed look on his face. "Why did the backpack break it when the crowbar wouldn't? What do you have in there?"
"I told you, some paper," I said. "A few colored pencils," stepping through the hole in the door into the darkness.
Owen followed close behind, making sure I didn't get more than 3 feet from him. We crunched glass under our feet. The air stung our nostrils like dirty socks soaked in vinegar. Years of decay and mold. Owen held the flashlight, guiding our way inside.
"I assume you know where you're going?" he whispered.
"I hope," I replied.
"You hope?"
"Here's the front desk," I said, running my hand through the thick dust and causing it to swirl into the air. "I remember this is where we started. The field trip, I mean. We started here. Then Hedda took us up to the second floor and showed us around up there." I wandered off down the hall, leaving Owen behind, holding the flashlight and watching me sink into the blackness.
"Hey, wait a second," he said.
I waved him up to join me. When he caught up, he began to speak, but I silenced him with a finger to my mouth.
"Shh, listen."
Owen was silent, his head cocked, listening.
"What?"
"Shh." There was a sound, a shuffling, quiet but still distinct. It came from further up the hall. I started walking slowly, choosing my steps and trying to make as little noise as possible. The shuffling came again. I rounded a corner and heard Owen follow close behind. I let my ears guide me, knowing that in this darkness, flashlight or no, my eyes were of little use. Again, the shuffling. Just a little further. Maybe around the next corner, or the one after that, but definitely no further. Owen made the beam of light dance back and forth across the floor in front of us. I kept moving. The noise was almost right in front of me, probably almost right on top of me. I wasn't sure, and I could hardly see a thing. We passed a few doors, bumping into them because we were letting the wall take us on a straight course down the hall. I heard the shuffling once more before I felt the thing I bumped into. I hit it and uttered a frightened gasp. Owen jumped at the sound of it and aimed the light at me. I grabbed the flashlight from him and pointed it toward the thing I had bumped into. My first instinct was, "Don't trust your senses." But that thought was quickly quelled when I realized whose eyes I was looking into. They were big and emotionless, like a dog's eyes. That phrase, "like a dog's eyes," made me remember the little girl I had seen in the hall during my first tour of the place on that Friday in March. I remembered seeing her and thinking that about her eyes, then looking back a second later and realizing she was gone. I'd never asked anyone else if they'd seen her, and no one asked me. I assumed someone else had. The whole group had walked right past her. But now, seeing her here in the dark, years later, I doubted anyone in the class had set eyes on the little girl with the black hair and the dog's eyes. We stared at each other for a moment. Owen asked, "Todd, who the hell is this?" "Don't worry, she's all right." I turned to her. "What are you doing here?" I asked her in the most gentle voice I could find after such a day. She didn't answer, just kept looking at me. I thought of the little man. "Well, if you can't answer, can you at least show us where to go?" At this request, the little girl turned around and shuffled her feet, which I saw by shining the light on them, were clad in bunny slippers, down the dark hall. Owen and I followed, trying not to lose sight of her for fear we wouldn't be able to find her again, that whatever was trying to keep us away would take her and hide her from us. She led us to a door that had a small metal sign hanging in the middle of it. I saw that the sign used to read "Stairs" before most of the letters had worn off. I grabbed the knob and tried to turn it. The handle was stiff and made a sound like the one the gate had made when I opened it. I felt the backpack move on my back in anticipation. The door squeaked open and I stepped into the stairwell. Owen followed. I wasn't surprised to see that the little girl was already in front of me, even though I'd been the first to step inside. "The third floor, wasn't it?" I asked. In response, she turned and headed up the first flight. Halfway up the stairs, Owen grabbed me and whispered, "When was the last time you stopped and thought about what you're doing here? I mean, I know what we're here for is real. I was there when the crows attacked. I've got the blood on my ankle to remember it by. And I saw the old man walking with us. But, I mean, are we going to be able to walk away from this?" Standing with one leg on the step above me, I said, "I really don't know. But when was the last time you thought about it?" "About 8 seconds ago. Owen, I haven't thought of anything else since I realized what was going on." The stairwell was dark, but it had windows and, dirty though they were, they let a small amount of moonlight in, enough to give a tiny bit of illumination. I didn't need the flashlight now to see the girl walking, slowly, almost as if she were terrified of what lay on the next step, up the stairs. She wore a dirty gray gown, like a nightgown, that came to just below her knees. Her hair was as stringy and unwashed as the first time I'd seen her. I felt an amount of grief for her. I was sure she had been a wonderful little girl in life, and I was even more sure that she hadn't asked to play a part in this game. We passed a door that read, "Second floor." We followed the girl up the next flight.
"Only 2 more flights to go," Jack said. "I told you could do it, Todd. Hot fucking shit, you're really here and ready to do this."
"No, Jack," I thought. No matter how long I was given to get myself prepared, I'd never be ready to do this. The backpack, or whatever its contents were, squirmed anxiously. We rounded the landing and stepped onto the last flight. I had to lift my leg in my hands to get it going. The soreness was pretty much gone by now. Owen cleared his throat and followed me up. Finally, as if it had taken an eternity and a week, the little girl stopped at the door leading to the third floor. I arrived a second later, and then Owen. Owen looked at me, then the girl. I looked from one to the other, and the girl looked at me. "I wonder," I thought, "if she even knows Owen's with me." I decided she must. I slung the backpack higher on my shoulder, looked at the girl, and said, "Thank you for showing us the way." I reached out for the door handle and gripped it. Then I drew my hand back with a hiss and held it to my chest.
"Jesus, it's frozen. It's so cold it burns."
Owen grabbed it and held his hand to it. Then he let go, and I took hold of it again.
"But it was cold a second ago."
"Remember the crows," Owen said. "It doesn't want you here."
"It doesn't want us here,"
I corrected. I turned the handle. I pushed the door open, stepped back, and beheld a strange sight. On the other side of the door was light. Electric light, I thought, for it was coming from the overhead bulbs that swung back and forth above us. The light wasn't very bright, but it was light. I began to ask the girl if the electricity was still being pumped into the place, but when I turned to look at her, she was gone. I looked into the hall again. Then I stepped in. I walked to the gate and looked at it, wondering if it was unlocked. The backpack was practically trying to throw itself off my back now. Owen went into the hall and looked around. I wrapped my fingers around the handle on the gate, then gave it a hard tug on one side. It seemed to budge a little, but it wasn't moving enough to slip through.
"Come here,"
I said. Owen came and grabbed the handle over my own hands. The gate creaked a little toward us. We each gave heartier tugs for the next 5 or 10 minutes while the gate slowly worked itself free. When it was open, we walked down the hall. The lights continued swinging, and the sparse light the near-dead bulbs offered threw weird shadows around us. The green metal doors loomed on either side. I thought of my dreams. I had a notebook full of them, and these doors were mentioned on almost every page. "Do you know which one it is?" Owen asked. I nodded, and then, as an afterthought, added, "Even if I didn't, this pack is practically pulling me toward it."
"Todd," Owen said, "out of curiosity, what the hell is in that bag?"
"I already told you.
It's not just pencils and paper, is it?" I shrugged. I really didn't know. Owen looked away from me and asked, "Which one, then?"
I tiptoed down the hall, watching the shadows dance about me. The door I wanted was on the right, a little further up. Owen followed. I stopped, looking at the door in front of me. The slot was closed. I went to grab the handle when I felt something brush my leg. I jumped and looked. It was the girl.
"Jesus,"
I said, sighing relief. "I guess you're not finished here, are you?" Her reply was a long, pathetic stare. "Right," I said, and grabbed the knob at the side of the slot. I slid it open slowly, not knowing what to expect, but knowing I should expect something. It was open less than an inch when I peered inside. The inside of the room was as I remembered it. Padded, white, small. There was a bit of light coming in through the barred window. In the dimness, I could almost begin to make out a small shape, huddled up into one of the far corners. I opened the slot a bit more, then shone the flashlight into the corner. It was the man. He was rolled into a ball, cowering there. But there was something wrong about him. I looked closer, but couldn't tell what it was. Owen asked, "Is he in there?" I said, "Yeah, he's in there, but..."
"But what?"
"I don't know. There's something wrong with him." Owen grabbed the door handle and began to pull the door open. I slid my fingers into the space between the door and the frame and pulled. The door creaked open, the hinges rusted and stiff. When it was fully open, we both stepped into the room and were enveloped in the darkness. I stepped closer to the man. He didn't move, only lay there on the floor, afraid to budge. I aimed the light at him and, from inside the room, could tell almost at once what was wrong with him.
"He's transparent."
"Transparent?" Owen said.
"Yeah, it's like...
Wait a minute. Well, obviously, he's a ghost." I slid the backpack off again and reached inside. This time I brought out a stack of 30 or more sheets of paper. Owen would have recognized them from the hospital if I'd shown them to him. "I drew these without even thinking about it," I said. "They just came to me. Remember that dream about the game show?" Owen nodded. "It's kind of like that, except I drew these before coming here." I separated the pictures, putting the man in one pile and the bugs in another. I gave the bug pictures to Owen, who looked at them, grimaced in disgust, and held them down at his side. "Hold these until I tell you," I said. Then I stamped the pictures of the man on the floor, straightening them. I stood up. The little girl was in the room and she came over to me. "Are you going to help me with this?" I asked. "I don't know how I'm supposed to make this work." Her eyes said yes, she would help. Suddenly, she raised her arms in the air, straight above her. Then she brought them down quickly, swinging them out to the sides, and she began to dance. I picked up the pictures and held them in the crook of my elbow and began to tear off sheets one by one, tossing them into the air. They gathered around the girl, who danced in a circle about the room. She whirled and twirled, and the pages followed her. Owen watched, fascinated. The little girl danced in a spiral. The pictures floated up into the air on the wind she created. Then they came back down, landed on the floor, and stayed there. I watched as the pages began to swell. The pencil lines darkened. They lifted themselves from the pages in convulsions like erratic breathing. The little girl danced around them, bringing them to life. The reality, the detail in them, made life possible. The images freed themselves from the paper and became ghost images. They were as transparent as the man in the corner. They were ghost images of him, each one a duplicate of the next. They crawled about the room, lost. The girl continued dancing about, twirling her arms in the air and jumping around. I kept tossing pictures in the path of her dancing, and the pictures continued coming to life. The backpack jumped, and I knew I would be using it soon. Shortly, the images started heading in the right direction, drawn toward the man. I thought he must know what's going on because I saw him twitch in expectation a few times. When we got to within a few feet of him, the ghost seemed to melt into him, like he was absorbing them. "That's just what he's doing," I thought. "He's making himself more real." They seeped into him, and finally he was solid again. He leaned up, lifting his head, opened his eyes, and, as if it were his birth cry, croaked, "Bugs!" Excited that it was all happening, I jumped in the air and actually yipped in triumph. The sound made Owen jump, and he dropped the pictures he was holding. He bent down to get them. "Sorry," I said, "but look at him. He's real now. I made him real. I drew him and made him real." I went to the man and knelt beside him. Owen watched and said, "You're right there. It was pretty amazing." I hooked the man by one of the straps on his straitjacket and hauled him up. His legs useless after so long, he collapsed back to the floor. I looked at Owen and said, "Can you give me a hand here?"
"Sure."
Owen came over and together we hauled him out of the room. As we approached the door, Owen asked, "So now that we've got him and he's real again, what do we do with him?"
"I still don't know," I said.
The man tried to get his legs under him and give us a little help as we carried him out of the room. His head was bent down with his chin against his chest, and I thought I heard him weeping. We entered the hall, and I looked down toward the gate. It stood open still. The lights overhead were still swinging back and forth, throwing their shadow shapes around, dancing on the walls. I thought about the little girl and her dancing, and I wondered what else she was capable of. I looked around, but she was gone again. I leaned forward and said into the man's ear, "We're almost there. There's the gate. We're almost out of here."
Your dad'd be proud of what you're doing here, Owen said.
My dad would shit his pants if he knew what we were doing here.
That too. The lights overhead swung more wildly, creating bigger arcs as they gained momentum. They swung back and forth so hard I could hear them cutting the air. Then the arcs became so wide the lights shattered against the ceiling. One after another, the lights went out as they were destroyed. The hall was slowly enveloped in darkness, and we jumped when we heard the loud clang of the gate swinging shut. Then there was darkness everywhere, and silence. In the silence, we heard something. It started quiet, but grew louder and louder until it was all we could hear. It was the man. He'd slipped out of our arms and was sitting on the floor, laughing. Slowly, almost so slowly it was imperceptible until Owen and I could see each other in the dark, a green light began to glow at the opposite end of the hall. It was dim at first, and I thought maybe it was residue of the light I was used to seeing still on my eyes. Just green flashes dancing around in front of me. Then I saw that the light was stationary and growing. I closed my eyes for a second, giving them a brief rest, and opened them again, trying to focus on the weird light that seemed to be coming closer. "What the fuck?" we both said, then looked at each other. Owen pressed himself against the wall next to the gate. I was opposite him, the backpack pinning me to the wall. The light stopped about 20 feet in front of us. Then we saw, standing in the midst of it, a tall figure. I thought of the game show dream and thought, no, I won't accept this part of it. The rest is strange enough. I don't need this to be real, too. The figure extended a long, bony hand with long, bony fingers, and I thought the fingers might have a too few many joints. The hands curled around as if to give us the finger, but instead the fingers beckoned the man to come to it. He crawled to it and cowered at its feet, whimpering quietly.
I see, despite my efforts, you're here anyway.
Jesus Christ, Owen said.
No,
the thing replied simply. The face was everything and more that I had dreamed. It had the horns and the pointed ears, and I could see the folded wings sticking up from its back. The face was a rotted, sickly color full of lines and scars. But the one thing I hadn't dreamed was its eyes. I thought nothing could be worse than looking into the man's eyes, but this was far, far worse. It was like looking into a millennium of hatred, and I had to close my own eyes to keep from going mad. Todd, Owen said from the other side of the hall, what is this? I thought you said not to take that dream so literally. The figure laughed, a loud, braying laughter that echoed throughout the entire hall, bouncing back and forth on the walls and ringing in our ears. Then it closed its mouth with a snap, and its teeth clicked together. It looked at Owen, its devilishly red eyes piercing him.
You think I'm Lucifer,
it said. Owen looked from the monster to me. The thought had been so foremost in both our heads, it couldn't have been difficult to pick it out. I watched the thing watch Owen. The backpack was trying to throw itself off my back and get to work. I let it slide off my shoulder and caught one of the straps in my hand. The motion had seemed so casual, the thing didn't seem to pay it any attention. I held the bag in one hand and grabbed the zipper with the other. What are you? I asked. The demon looked at me and smiled.
Merely an underling in the prince's dark kingdom.
It stroked the man's head as if he were a pet.
I see you've made the acquaintance of Caleb. I'm sorry, but I won't be able to let you take him with you when you go. Caleb and I made an arrangement a long time ago. I would cure his disease, and he would be mine, forever and ever.
As if to prove the point of his rule, the thing dug its nails into Caleb's head and pulled his head back, digging 4 long, deep scars into his skull. The man screamed and blood ran into his left eye. He put his head in his hands and rocked back and forth, sobbing. I looked at him, then looked at the demon. Caleb looked up at me, his eyes pleading. I couldn't abandon him here now. Not after everything I'd already gone through up to this point. Now that the thing knew he had tried to bring someone in to rescue him, he would tear Caleb apart an inch at a time if I left him now. The demon let his eyes go from me to Owen. I kept my eyes on the demon, knowing that the man was watching me, trying to remember how I had ignored that gaze in Angel Hill. It seemed like it should be easy. Just don't think about it. But now, with everything I had dreamed coming to life, blocking out the man's stare was easier said than done.
Almost there, Todd. Just unzip that backpack and let the fun begin.
Slowly, I slid the zipper over, trying to keep it quiet. The bag jigged in my hands, trying to free itself and hurry the job on its own. But I held tight to it. Owen stood to the side, watching everything, but unable to participate. The demon laughed again and moved toward us.
I just realized something,
it said.
I said I couldn't let you leave with Caleb. On second thought, I don't think I'll be able to let you leave at all. I think it would be more fun to keep the two of you, like pets.
For a second, I began to doubt that it would work. My hand paused on the zipper, wondering. My leg had stopped hurting. I wondered if the pain I'd felt earlier was just another attempt to keep me away. The demon raised a hand toward me, the fingers outstretched, as if to grab something. My soul, perhaps.
Without any further thought or consideration as to whether it would work or not, I yanked the zipper open. I held the strap in one hand and with the other grabbed the front flap. I pulled it down and thrust the backpack into the thing's face. A few pencils fell out and hit the floor. I saw that they turned to bugs as they landed. I let the bag go, dropping it to the floor. Then I stepped back and watched as the bugs began to devour the rancid flesh of the thing. They crawled about its skin, some of them burrowing into it. The demon, not having known any other fear than the wrath of the prince, seemed to have been taken completely by surprise. It couldn't have been described as fright. It was merely a startled shock that made him step back and take a second gander at things. He yelled in a surprised gasp and held his hands to his face. The bugs ignored the gesture and crept over his hands, too. They were oblivious to everything except eating whatever was in their way. Then the actual sensation of having his flesh devoured hit him, and the monster began to shriek. My eyes widened as I watched the bugs at work. I thought about the trip and the first time I had seen the bugs in my bag. I remembered feeling their spiny legs crawling over my hands, my arms, and finally my face. I remembered wanting to cry out, then thinking about them crawling into my mouth and down my throat, and that being the deciding factor in not screaming. I remembered the curiosity I felt the first time I heard the man, whom I now knew was named Caleb, reciting his now familiar, "Bugs, bugs, 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 bugs." I had wondered what he was saying. I heard him, but couldn't make out the words. All I wanted was to know what he was saying. I found out. But that finding out had placed me in the spot of elected savior. Caleb looked up at the demon. Then he looked at me. The look on my face gave him the first real burst of hope that he'd had since the thing had deceived him. He looked into my eyes, and in a moment, I understood. He'd stayed under the monster's finger until I came by, and, for a reason I neither knew nor argued, I could hear him. I must have been an angel compared to the things he had seen in hell. He locked onto me and stayed with me, in one form or another, until he saw his means of escape. The pills. He had slipped into my dreams and then began showing himself, letting me know he was there, and in need of me. He manipulated my dreams, molding them into a replay of the things he had known, the things that had happened to him. He made me come to him. He needed me. Now Caleb, blood running down his face, kneeling at the thing's side, and having begun to give up hope of rescue, saw new inspiration in my eyes. He began his repetition, quietly, nearly whispering, "Bugs, bugs, 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 bugs." I was the only one who heard it. Owen was still up against the wall, probably in shock. I wondered what had happened to him. Before the horned demon showed up, Owen had been showing the courage I needed him to show for this. But now he was useless. Then I was absorbed by Caleb's speech as the words slowly became louder. As I watched, the bugs worked with more ferocity at the monster. They dug deeper and ran faster across its face. They burned themselves into its flesh. The flyers took off, flew to the ceiling, then dove at it, plunging deep into its skin. He screamed again and the walls shook. As the bugs chewed away at it, the demon's anger rose. This manifested itself in a growing of the light. It became so bright, I nearly had to close my eyes. It gave off a fantastic heat, and some of the bugs burned away, their charred bodies landing scattered around the floor. Caleb's voice rose to a fever pitch. The bugs, as soon as their black and dead bodies hit the floor, began to flip themselves over and crawl right back to the task they had just left. The pictures were rolled up next to Owen's knees. They unrolled themselves and spread out, as if by an unfelt breeze, on the floor. As with the pictures of Caleb, they convulsed and brought themselves to life. I saw it and wondered if the little girl was somewhere, dancing. Unlike the other pictures, these didn't disappear as soon as they were animated. Instead, the pages issued forth an army of bugs, each identical to the insect on the paper. They fleshed themselves out, pulled their legs free of the page, then crept to the thing they were to bring down. Cockroaches, beetles, crickets.
"Bugs! Bugs! Bugs!"
Caleb shrieked at the top of his lungs. It had been a long time since he'd screamed, except in pain, and I didn't know how long he would be able to keep it up. He looked around and saw me watching him. His voice then began to echo throughout the hall and down the stairs. He took up the call with renewed vigor, and his eyes, though he was no longer completely under the demon's control, again became bloodshot. The bugs took to the rotted flesh as if it were the best meal they'd ever had. I saw something out of the corner of my eye. At first I wanted to ignore it and pray it would go away. I didn't want to admit its existence, not even after so much had already happened. On the floor, I saw a pair of hands reaching up through the tiles. They seemed to be melting outward, like the hands in my dreams of Caleb had. Those hands had come up, reached for Caleb, and then tried to drag me down afterward. But those hands had been situated around him in a circle. These weren't. They were spaced sporadically about the hall. I watched them come up. The hands, the wrists, the arms. All were attached to bodies, and the bodies were transparent, as Caleb had been when we found him cowering in his room. The girl stood to the side, watching. I wondered if she'd brought the cavalry. Caleb himself was now trying to stand, pulling himself up by one of the doors, holding the handle.
The whole time, though, he never let his call falter.
Bugs! Bugs! Bugs!
He called furiously, and he kept calling, watching the figures rise from beneath them. Owen stood there watching it all. He looked like he might be sick. I stood against the opposite wall. The backpack was on the floor next to me, and crawling from it in a line that seemed infinite were thousands of bugs. I think by that point the charm of the adventure had worn off and neither of us wanted to be here anymore. Owen turned around and tried to pry the gate open, but it wouldn't budge. The bugs marched on, eating away at the thing. It tried brushing them off, but they wouldn't go away. They kept coming and coming. They tore at its flesh. They wedged themselves in between its lips and crawled down its throat. A large brown roach, with hard, shell-like wings on its back, crept into its pointed ear. There were bugs picking at his fingers. Black, oily blood dripped from the sores. The monster opened its wicked eyes and saw the phantoms lumbering toward it through the air. Its eyes became O's as the phantoms bore down, combining with the bugs in a joint effort to destroy the beast. They took him by surprise and gave him no time to retaliate. He was dragged to the floor, and to me it looked like they were all locked in a devilish football tackle. The monster fought back, trying to throw bugs and phantoms off in quick repetition. But the bugs returned as soon as they were thrown, and the phantoms, after being released by the girl and let loose to their full fury and rage, refused to be beaten. They attacked with the intense savagery of all their years of built-up anger. Caleb kept screaming, never letting up. I watched with the same curiosity I'd peeked in at him with 5 years earlier. The thing on the floor let out a scream. The attack kept up, never letting him get a second of concentration with which to fight back. He reached out of the mass of things covering him with a scabby, half-eaten arm. He tried to fight his way up, but they simply strengthened their attack and he was dragged back down. Caleb called his army forth and the bugs kept coming. The louder he shouted, the bigger and more numerous the bugs became. I looked at the bag on the floor. It pulsed with a kind of mystic life of its own. The bugs crept and crawled out of it. I thought after this was all over, if it ever ended, I would leave the bag there. I didn't think I would be able to touch it ever again. I heard another ear-shattering, air-splitting shout, a scream of infernal horror and pain. I looked at the demon, covered in a coat of insects and ghosts. It pressed its knees into the floor and tried to lift itself again. As before, the things on its back wouldn't let it up. I crouched against the wall, watching everything from behind my hands which were covering my face. Owen was still tugging at the gate, trying with everything he had to get it open and get out, when I saw the thing, the demon, the monster, being dragged even further than the floor. He was being dragged down into the floor. The attackers, the bugs, the lunatic spirits, were taking it down for good. The thing shrieked again as it began to sink into the tiles and into defeat. The light it shone grew to one final burst of nova brightness before blinking out. It flickered like a slow strobe. Then it went out for longer periods of time, coming on for only a second before vanishing again. Soon, the light in the hall was gone. Then there was silence. I looked up from my hands. After a few seconds, my eyes grew used to the darkness. Owen stopped tugging and looked around, wondering what was wrong. Caleb sat on the floor like a lump of clay. I got up and walked slowly to him on legs that kept threatening to give out. I knelt by him, put a hand on his shoulder, and Caleb looked up at me. His eyes were no longer bloodshot, and he finally, thank God, stopped calling the bugs. He was silent. He looked into my eyes with his brown ones. Then he tried to mouth the words, "Thank you." No sound came from his lips, but I knew what he was saying. In response, I said, "You're welcome." I stood and asked, "Now what happens?" The straitjacket Caleb had worn for so long came unclasped, and his arms fell free. He stood up and shrugged it off, then looked around the hall, as if searching for something. He found the door to his room and walked toward it.
"Wait," I started. "What are you doing?"
Caleb looked at me again, and I saw by the expression on his face that everything was all right now, that it was safe to enter the room. He grabbed the handle with one hand, slid the panel over with the other, closing the slot. He opened the door. I saw Owen standing by the gate. He seemed calm for the first time since the demon had appeared. The look on his face told me that everything would be okay with him, too. Caleb walked into the room on legs that were working for the first time in ages. I wondered how long, then decided it wasn't important. The fact that he was safe now was all that mattered. He disappeared behind the door, and I noticed a little girl standing in the hall a few doors away. I hadn't seen her slip by, and I asked, "How long have you been standing there?" She glided past, and I heard her say in the softest voice I'd ever heard, "A long time." She disappeared into the room with Caleb. Then the door slammed shut. I looked at Owen again. He was still standing against the gate. I went to the door and grabbed the knob at the side of the panel. I slid it open a little and put my eye to it, peeking in as I had in high school. The room was empty. I closed the panel, smiling. When I returned to the gate, Owen asked what happened in the room. I told him. Together, we yanked the gate open and walked to the stairwell door. Before the door closed, I glanced over my shoulder and looked at the backpack laying on the floor in a heap of nylon. We descended a spiral corridor, then in the dark with a flashlight beam to guide us, found the front door.
We stepped through the hole, crunching more broken glass. We walked toward the front gate together, watching the stars. We got to the street and had to pick a direction to go. Owen turned to me and asked, "What do we do now?" Still looking up at the sky, I smiled, twirled the pencils in my pocket, and said, "I don't know." This has been The Man in the Window, an Angel Hill novel, written by C. Dennis Moore, narrated by Greg Walston. Copyright 2011 by Charles Moore. Production copyright 2014.